Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. You know, the funny thing about looking for stories on the debt crisis that don't involve raising the debt ceiling is literally like a needle in a haystack. There are so few stories. I found two, and I consider myself lucky to do that. I had to go back to 2011 to do it, but if you look at the stories out there, they're all the same. You have to raise the debt ceiling because, and it's always followed by some, you know, we have to pay our obligations, you know, the economy's going to go into crisis, you know, grandmothers will be thrown out in the street, and, you know, just all these horrible things will happen if we don't raise the debt ceiling. But the fundamental illogic, the paradox, the oxymoron of the words debt ceiling, when all they do is raise it, you know, is staggeringly stupid, and it's all pure propaganda. They want to raise it because they want to spend more money. And even the insurrectionist himself, the thief in chief, the person we think is more competent than we thought originally, you know, he's just a, you know, he never wanted to be president. He always wanted to be dictator. And now we know that, you know, one Joseph Biden, who presently occupies the White House illegally, said that, no, we have to raise the debt ceiling, you know, and it's just, wait a minute, I forgot exactly what he said. Hang on. He says it's not, I remember now, I'm still getting used to the 6 o'clock hour here. It's kind of crazy. But anyway, he said it's not about, you know, future spending. It's about present spending. Well, that, of course, is a blatant lie. It is about future spending. Because if it was about present spending, then the government would have already shut down. That our credit would have already been, you know, slashed. We already would have defaulted if this, in fact, were current spending. I mean, that's obvious. That's obvious to me. I think it's obvious to a few people. It's not obvious to everybody else because they're going along with, oh, yeah, I got to raise the debt ceiling. Because people don't see the consequences of it. They don't see what raising the debt ceiling means, you know, where you see it is inflation. Where you see it is in, you know, just a gradual reduction of spending other places. Where you see it is the fact that the defense budget is rapidly being, I think it's already been overtaken by the interest on the national debt. Interest is just dead money. Interest is money you pay to somebody else because you borrowed too much. You know, if you incur interest, then you screwed up. You know, you goofed. You took on too much debt because now you're paying interest. I mean, a mortgage is the whole basis of a mortgage is interest. You know, it's called a mortgage for a reason. It's a death contract. Mortgage. Death contract. You know, you will pay the bank on pain of death. Otherwise, they take your house. And you take your house a lot of times in the old days. You know, there wasn't a lot of places to go. All right, let's bring Gene in the conversation. I'm ranting for a little bit here. And so let's see what as soon as you can join us here. I know you're also busy doing stuff as well. There's always so much to do here at Action Radio. People don't realize behind the scenes. I realized yesterday, we'll talk about that in a minute too. But good morning, Gene. Initial impressions. Before you knew anything about Action Radio and me and this show and all that kind of stuff, what was your just general impressions when it appeared on the news that you had to raise the debt ceiling? Did you feel that personally? Was it just kind of some Washington thing? Was it like, don't bother me? Or was it like, well, how much is the debt? I mean, what did you think of it before you got involved in all this stuff here? I'm just curious.
Well, I still don't have a good idea what it really, really means.
Okay.
But even back then, my first thought was, we need to live within our means. And number two is, who's going to pay for it?
Ooh,
you know, it's not
yeah.
us, because we're going to be long gone and we're still going to have this debt. But people that have children, their children, it's never going to get paid off.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's the idea. That's what I'm trying to think.
So then what happens? Then I'd be like, okay, then are we not the United States of America anymore? Because how can you keep living with outside of your means and be okay?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with, and this is something I'm going to probably ask, let me ask Derek about this. Who owns the debt? Because he knows that kind of stuff. Derek's our financial advisor. Here, Blunt at 7:30. Jim can't be with us. There's one Friday per month that Jim can't make it. Our gun reporter, Second Amendment reporter, and so this is that Friday, and so Jim will be off today, and he'll be back next week. And I've invited Donnie to come on a little earlier, Donnie Chapman. So we'll see if he can join us earlier, or he'll be on, you know, at 8:30 for the last half hour of the show. Derek will be here at 7:30, so he'll be here in about an hour and 25 minutes. You're rolling. You think, you know, 3 hours, what am I going to do it for 3 hours? And I'm already finding that 3 hours isn't enough. Yesterday, I could have gotten another hour easily with Dr. Judy Mikovits. And so it was fascinating. So let's ask Jim. Let's ask Derek, who owns the debt?
Hold on.
Cause that is a great question.
I got some money going on. I was something going on my phone. Sorry.
Okay.
Trying to check something out, and it's got its mind its own this morning.
Yeah, volume down, mic on. You know, so now here's the thing too. Gene and I are not in the same studio. And so what happens is we have to, you know, when somebody's on the air talking, you know, especially either one of us, you know, we have to, we text or Facebook or something like that. So we're always flying messages back and forth. So our phones are always on as well. The studio is always on. Of course, that can be a conflict because anything that comes over the phone gets picked up by the microphone and goes on the air. In fact, maybe we should start collecting bloopers, you know, when the dog barks, when the kid screams, you know, when you get a little birdie out the window, because sometimes people are sitting on their porch, sometimes they're driving, and, you know, you hear somebody screaming out the window. I mean, it's hysterical, some of the background noises we get doing this. It's live radio, and I think that's, you know, I think our mistakes are what give the show character. All the stupid things that happen that you'd normally edit out because they think, well, it's less than perfect. I think it's our less than perfect things sometimes that make the show more real. You know, we are real people. We do screw up. Things happen. Prime example being yesterday when and my sincerest apologies to John Cullen, who's turning out to be a, you know, ever more interesting person the more I get to know him and his information. He sent me a staggering amount of information yesterday. So this is the guest we couldn't connect with. So we're going to work on that. We're going to fix it up. We're going to get him next week. And he's just going to blow you all away with information. I was hoping to have Dr. Judy Mikovits join him and talk about the Spanish flu. And she was here, but he wasn't able to make it. And so Dr. Mikovits, you know, had all kinds of other stuff to talk about. So we easily fill the time with Judy Mikovits. And so you want to listen to yesterday's show, the last 40 minutes, and of course the whole of yesterday's show. We're covering a staggering amount of ground over the course of these 3 hours, I think, you know, more so than almost any other show, because we don't bombard you with you know, news breaks every half hour and, you know, just endless commercials and the commercials within the commercials, you know, the announcers, you know, making commercials and then playing more commercials. So we don't do that. I'd like to be able to, you know, well, as we get more commercials, I'm very selective when it comes to who is broadcast on our show in terms of commercials. But let me get back to where I started. Mistakes, background noise, Gene, what do you think? I mean, I kind of like the fact that we do broadcast everything, good or bad, right or wrong, bloopers, it's all there.
Right. And sometimes you say there's background noise and there's no noise in my background, so I don't know where the noise is coming from. But
well, not right now.
But yesterday even, there's nothing going on in my, you know, and it was like very interesting because you don't know what's going on through the airwaves either.
If we have six callers, if we had like four or five or six callers on the line and only takes one of them to make background noise, it's like trying to find out when some YouTube starts playing and you don't know which website it is. Where is this coming from? You know, it's a little corner ad somewhere playing. I didn't mean it was you yesterday. When I say there's background noise, it means I said there's somebody with background noise. What a lot of times I'll do is I'll just randomly mute people and just so I can find out where it is. And so I think – I'm not sure where it was yesterday, but sometimes it bounces around. Anyway, let me start with a question that you asked before. And anything's open today. So, Jane, if you want to change the topic, anybody wants to call in. Friday's kind of like catch-up day around here. And so I've got a ton of stories, and I've got a couple of news stories. And we've got a lot of time to get through different things today. And then, of course, I, you know, dump most of those stories and start fresh again over the weekend collecting things for the week. But the question, and I think Derek's going to answer this too, is who owns the debt? The debt is borrowed from the Treasury. So there's fiscal policy and there's monetary policy. So the Fed, as far as I know, runs monetary policy. You know, they set the interest rates. They control the money supply. And the interest rates and the discount rate to banks and some of those other things, they control how much money is actually circulating in the economy. they control, I think, the printing and the, and like I say, with restrictions, you know, the higher the interest, the more money costs. I mean, money has a cost to it. You actually have to pay money to get money. That's what a loan's all about. You know, interest is a charge. And so the higher the interest, the greater the cost of money. Well, the greater the cost of money, it's like the greater the cost of any other good. The more you raise the price, the less activity you're going to get. So raising the interest rates raises the cost of money, which slows the economy. That's what the Fed does. The Treasury, of course, has the money, you know, and so they're ones that actually they do the I think Congress does the fiscal policy, is how it's going to be spent and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so the Treasury has to find a way to, you know, pay the national debt. They got to pay the bills. And so the way they do this, they can either print it. No, I think Treasury does that. I'll start with Derek. He'll know exactly because he deals with this stuff all the time. So the money gets printed and the money is loaned out. And it's loaned out in the form of bonds, treasury bills, T-bills. You've heard of those, various other securities. And so the money is let out to be borrowed. Well, if people are going to, you know, lend you their money by purchasing treasury bills, treasury bonds, things like that, you got to pay them for the privilege because money costs money. Right. And so for all the $30 trillion of our national debt to pay that back is going to be a horrendous interest cost. In fact, the interest cost, I think, is 800 some odd billion a year now. It's actually higher than the defense budget. So we pay more dead money, as I call it. Interest is just dead. So we pay more dead money per year than we do to defend ourselves all over the world. That to me is staggering. Now, I put something in the on Facebook last night, and I got to check it because it's been kind of a crazy morning around here, as it always is every show. I should probably just stop saying that. But I put forward the idea that it's time for a constitutional amendment to remove the power of Congress to borrow money. And I heard a quote from Ron Paul yesterday. Not Rand Paul, Ron Paul, his dad, who said that Thomas Jefferson didn't want to have the power to borrow money put into the Constitution. And Thomas Jefferson, as usual, was completely right. And so we could have saved ourselves all this by simply not giving Congress the power to borrow money. And I'm not sure why they did it, other than they might have needed it for usually it's for wars. I mean, we borrowed money for World War II. But the government, a lot of times, was responsible enough that they wouldn't borrow like they're borrowing now. This borrowing now is a fairly recent phenomena. It's really since Obama that we started borrowing just these absolutely obscene, dare I say, pornographic amounts. You know, I mean, it's horrible what these people are doing. It's economic treason. It's economic suicide. And the word trillion doesn't seem to mean anything anymore. They become desensitized. It's like the more, you know, what is it, the more porn somebody watches, the more they become desensitized, the more they need the rush of more, whatever more is. You know, and the same thing I think happens with money, you know, with the debt. The more they get without the economy collapsing, it's sort of like saying, hey, I want more. You know, they get on this adrenaline rush. Well, more money. All we have to do is borrow it. This is great. You know, and it becomes an addiction. And Gene, let me ask you that question, because you're in the health profession. Addiction, a gambling addiction, a spending addiction, a credit card addiction. We really don't talk about that much, but because I don't really know much about it. But are there? You know, this might be a project if you want to kind of research this a little bit, either today or sometime. But the addiction to money. I mean, I've never really thought about that until literally just now. But credit cards, things like that. Is there a whole branch of our society that is addicted to spending? I mean, I know there are, but I don't know the extent of it and how bad it can be. But people that just, they'll keep getting credit card after credit card after credit card and keep borrowing. They'll buy things they don't even need just because they want to buy things. I mean, how bad can this get from your knowledge?
It can get extremely bad or difficult for the person involved. And the thing is, people, I don't want to say we all have addictions, but we really do. We all have something. You know, if something goes wrong in our life or something happens that we don't really care for, what do? Some people go to drugs. Some people go to alcohol. Some people spend. Some people, you know, go to sex. There's so many different addictions out there. But
comfort food.
My concern
is their comfort food. You know,
right, yeah.
Whatever
my
it might
be. My concern is with this budget thing, it's like, we need to look at what needs to be done. And all these pet projects should not be allowed. You should not have a pet project in a bill. I'm sorry. That pork needs to be gone. We don't need to spend, what is it, $100 million or however much it is for a park in San Francisco. I'm sorry. I like parks, but I'm sorry. It's like me living in you know, middle of nowhere land when you consider the lockdown last year and how many states would not allow their people to go to work where other states did. And why now do we bail out people that, you know, that their states were incompetent with making decisions? That's who they voted in office.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Most states can't borrow money. You know, they have to balance their budgets. A lot of states are that way. And so it's really interesting how it works. Certain states, I think California is not one of them. It's interesting. I bet you if you took a poll, you'd find that the Democrat states are the ones that can borrow money and the Republican states are the ones that don't, just because they're more fiscally responsible. And the problem is with Congress, you know, they actually reward the spenders. The spenders get rewarded because the people in their district go, look, you spent money on me. This is great. Oh, wow. You know, you're the right person. And I remember this, there was a woman who was on one of the city councils. It might be even in the Chicago City Council, Midwest Council, or Detroit. It's probably either Chicago or Detroit. And she was saying, you know, you got to bring home the bacon. That's what you do. You know, in fact, the whole purpose of government was to bring in money to people. And that's the exact opposite of what government's supposed to do. Government's supposed to protect life, liberty, and property. You know, government's actually, to me, as I look at this, the most fundamental duty of government is to protect us from government. You know, and it'd be an interesting constitutional principle if we wrote one that's from government. In other words, the purpose is to get people in there who understand that all power corrupts and don't want to rule over people. You know, so you know, anybody that wants to apply for government, those are the people that should be thrown out. You know, the people that want to rise up in power, the career government people, those are the ones you want to get rid of. You know, anybody that comes up with new regulations, new things. Yeah, you know, I want the people in that are going to get rid of, you know, regulations. In fact, I have two bills we've never really talked about. These are one of the first couple that I wrote. And I actually wrote them for two individuals, one being Mike Huckabee and the other being Newt Gingrich. And for Mike Huckabee, I wrote the Department of Freedom. And the Department of Freedom, see, no government's ever had a Department of Freedom. So the Department of Freedom's job would be to go through all the other departments and get rid of their regulations that are not constitutional. And that regulations would have to go through the Department of Freedom before they could go to Congress or be imposed on the American people or things like that. And the head of the Department of Freedom would probably be an elected position. And so in other words, you know, imagine having people in government have to run on how much freedom they would bring you. And it's a bizarre concept of government, but I think it's absolutely essential. And I thought Huckabee would be the best person for the job. The second department was the Department of Innovation. And this is the one I wrote for Newt Gingrich. And it's unfortunate that I wrote these maybe five years ago, and that I have not been able to reach either one of them to say, look, I got a bill just for you. This is you. And Gingrich, because he's a visionary, because he has the ideas, and he's open to the ideas, and he would be the one that would appreciate the fact that, you know, I'm trying to get the government 100 years of where they are now. Think 100 years into the future. You know, think of the systems that you're going to need. Think of the innovations. Think beyond computers. Think beyond regulatory agencies. So the biggest charge in the Department of Innovation is to come up with a new kind of government that doesn't have regulatory agencies. Okay. And so this is, people listening are going, what? I think I just blew everybody's mind as they spit their coffee across the room. He wants to do what? Yes, you're right. I want to get rid of bureaucracies, because bureaucracies go back to the most ancient forms of government. They're always the twiddlies. They're always the minions. They're always the people that want to control everything you do. And to them, it's like orgasmic. I mean, this is what they do. They're on a power trip. And this is what makes them, what makes their day. Is to take power over people. You know, that's why people run the FBI, and that's why people have these big offices in Washington, and you know, the EPA, and you know, these different agencies out there that screw around with your life. The BLM, when they took the Bundy Ranch, I mean, it's all about power. It's all it is. It's all about power. Power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. A bit like Henry Kissinger, who said it, powder is the ultimate aphrodisiac. There we go. There's my Henry Kissinger for this morning. But it is. So let me go back to you, Gene. Power. What do they teach you in psychology or just, you know, experience that you might have had with people that it's the love, it's not the love of money, the root of all evil. It's the love of power. Power, that's the root of all evil. Curious.
Yeah, I just think for some people, once they get a little power, it does go to their heads. But then I think it has to do with a lot with the person themselves, how grounded they are, what's their reason for doing anything? Because if you look at things, the people that let power go to their head, oftentimes it's not always the righteous reason why they're pursuing something anyway. It's more to be like, oh, look at me, or what thump their chest or get all kinds of money. And, you know, the bottom line is this. It's like there is an infinite amount of money. So people, you know, people should be paid what they're worth. But I also think that we need to, when we're doing anything in mm-hmm. life, it's like, are we doing it? Are we taking advantage of someone just for our means? Or is this a fair trade? Or what is really going on? But, oh, yeah, definitely. I think once some people get the feel of what it feels like to have power, and it may not even be with making decisions, but walking into a room and everybody just starts, like, you know, running up to them and paying homage to them or whatever. That's easy to get into that, I don't want to say mindset, but that way of being, and just want more and more and more, because that's like a drug. You know, attention's like a drug. Ooh, people like me, people, you know, think I'm special, whatever. Yeah.
And the quickest way to get people to like you is to spend money on them.
That's true.
We talked about this yesterday, you know, with my own congressman, Matt Gaetz, you know, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and how some of these folks, you know, they came in with the best of intentions, but they literally get seduced by the dark side of the force. The circus complete, old man, and now I am the master. Anyway, I keep channeling different voices into my head here. But it's true that, you know, and I've been sort of hesitant to complain about my congressman because I believe he was doing the right thing. Now I'm wondering if the attention has overtaken, the attention has overtaken the intentions. And so this is something that I think people lose sight of. And if money is power and spending money gets people to like you, and you walk in with the best intentions of being a crusader and an independent, and then all of a sudden you get the talk from your leader of Congress, whether it's Democrat or Republican, they all get the same talk. You know, your career is going to go two. Your career is going to go one of two ways. Yeah. Go ahead, Gene. What were you going to say?
I was going to say if they want money for their campaign and stuff. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, you're going to do what they say.
Exactly. Well, not necessarily. There are some people who don't, and of course they go to the, you know, their office gets put in the men's room or, you know, where, or the janitor's closet or something like that. You know, that actually happened in the state of Massachusetts when I was in college. There was a speaker that was incredibly powerful. I've forgotten his name now, but he actually assigned someone he didn't like, you know, to the men's room. That's where their office was. So the state level is amazing what goes on. It would have made national news if it was Congress. But anyway, can you imagine Nancy Pelosi, you know, putting, I don't know, who would be a good person? Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, in the ladies' room, you know, the basement of the Capitol. That's your office now. That's what I've assigned you, you know. But it's interesting that if you walk in with the best of intentions, you get the talk and you realize that if you don't play ball, as they say, that you don't get your committee chairs, you don't get your trips, you don't get your prestige, and all your fellow Congress people who are playing ball will hate you. Because they're playing ball because, you know, they think everybody's playing ball, so it's okay. And you get the dissenters saying, no, it's not okay. Then, you know, like the Rand Pauls and the Ron Pauls and some of the other folks. Fortunately for Rand Paul, he's independent enough and has a big enough following. He doesn't have to play ball anymore. Same thing with Ted Cruz. But they didn't start out that way. And they did object to the Biden insurrection January 6th. So they were on the right side of it. I wasn't sure until I checked the vote. It was 12 senators and 146 House Republicans that actually objected to the fact that Biden was stealing the White House. So they can't object, but as we said before, they don't do what they really need to do other than those 12 senators and 146 representatives. You know, when it really comes down to it, the other members don't do what they need to do. And so they get in this situation where their fellow congresspeople love them because they're spending money. Their constituents love them. The lobbyists love them. The ones who take them to dinner, wine and dine, and offer trips and junkets, as they say, and all those other things, they love them. And they think that being loved, it's almost like it's almost like a dysfunctional relationship. So I love bringing this to the personal level. We'll get back to our credit card spender in a minute. But do you see this, you know, as a dysfunctional relationship where your value is how much money you bring to somebody else? It'd be like if you're in a relationship and your partner values you by how much money you spend on them. You know, especially if you end up borrowing money. In other words, if you use your credit card to spend money on this other person, you know, and it doesn't matter how much money you spend on it, it's never enough. So if you want their love, you know, you're going to keep borrowing money and getting more credit cards and raising the limit because that's how you buy your affection. I mean, can we put it on that kind of a personal level and translate that to Congress? Am I something? What do you think? I'm just curious.
I would definitely say yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So how does that work? How dependent can people get on a situation like that? I mean,
dependent.
I don't want names, of course, but I'm just curious, in the world of dysfunctional relationships, how common is this? I'm just curious.
I mean, I can't give you a percentage, but I would assume it's pretty common. Yeah, very common. I mean, if you look in, which is really sad, but if you look at things and it, really look at things and go by why people do anything. I mean, look at Nancy Pelosi. If you take her just for example, what she's doing there, it's insane. Because everything she does, it's like you do what she says, or she yanks your power, whatever she puts you in, or the money stuff, because she controls, even with the Democratic or even Republican national parties with their their donations they get.
So if she controls the committee chairs and she controls the campaign funds and she's, pretty much the head of the Democrat Party along with Schumer, but I think more to extent Pelosi, because she acts individually. The Senate has different rules. They have filibusters and they have different things. But the House is right now a dictatorship because of the party system, which is leading me to conclude that the best thing we can do for our freedom is to get rid of parties, to have all votes be secret. In terms of committee chairs, have the members vote for the committee chairs, and they can wheel and deal on their own. I don't care. I mean, but there has to be a way to break the power of the speaker, and the best way to break the power of the speaker is to get rid of any party affiliation in Congress so that these people are not dependent, on parties for the money. They actually have to go out and solicit donations from, if you're a wacko Democrat, you might go to the Sierra Club. If you're a Republican, a rhino, you might go to the Heritage Foundation. There are places you can go for lots and lots of money. I mean, they do that now, but I'm just saying if they do it on an individual basis rather than a party basis, it might be a very different situation in Congress, but she's way too powerful. And the problem is it's self-perpetuating because, the speaker controls the members of Congress. The members of Congress who don't vote for the speaker don't get their committee chairs. So their career is dependent on electing the person who's already there. And that's why it's so hard to unseat, a speaker of the House. And this is why when people say, and when they had these stories, I guess, a couple of years ago, oh, somebody's challenging Nancy Pelosi for the speaker of the House. Are you kidding me? If I can quote you. No, nobody's going to challenge Nancy Pelosi. As long as she wants to, they'll wheelchair her in there. And as long as she's got the gavel, as long as she's speaker of the House, she controls everybody in there. All right, let's go back to what you said. Let's go back to what you said earlier on the debt ceiling. You're not quite sure how it works. So this would be a good time for me to just take a brief period to really talk about what this is, because I think that's the best points, is that people don't understand what this is and nobody really explains this to them. So it's fairly simple in concept, but it gets very complicated when you start analyzing it. So the simple thing is Congress gets money. They get tax revenue, they get fees, they get duties, they get there's various sources of revenue that comes into the Treasury Department, the IRS. The IRS is the collecting arm of it. So money comes in. Well, let's say the government gets about $5 trillion. Well, it's actually less because of the lockdown. But just for the sake of argument, let's say they have $5 trillion, right? Because that's where it was headed. So $5 trillion per year comes into the Treasury. And so Congress, if they spend $5 trillion, they spend every penny that comes in, that would actually be a balanced budget. In other words, the amount of spending equals the amount of revenue. Okay. Most companies can't do that. They have to make a profit because they have shareholders to pay off. They want a company to grow. They want to reinvest in the company. So the whole basis of a free market system is that you actually increase. So your revenues are above your costs. And it'd be nice if that was true in Congress. And it could be. They just have to vote less spending, but they can't do that because we've just been over the whole reason about why they're addicted. They're in basically a dysfunctional relationship with their own party and with the people and with everything else. So this is why it's so fascinating to go through this stuff and as we kind of analyze this out. So that's how it happens. So ideally, Congress would spend less money than they take in every year, and they would put that surplus towards, savings, paying off different programs, buying different stuff, because the sooner they pay off a program, the less debt they incur, and they would actually not be adding, they would not have a deficit each year. Okay. So a deficit, which is the next phase. If they borrow too much, so say they want to spend $6 trillion worth of stuff and they only have, $5 trillion in revenue coming in. Well, they're like little two-year-olds. I mean, it's a two-year-old temper tantrum. So they stomp their feet and they run around. They whine like little babies and they say, we have to raise the debt ceiling. we have to borrow more money, okay? Because the debt ceiling means they can only borrow so much. And so they say, we want to borrow more. It's like calling up your credit card company and throwing a tantrum. I'm going to raise my own credit limit so that I can borrow more stuff. and you can't do anything about it. You know, this is the approach. And so Congress says, okay, we're going to raise the debt ceiling. So now we can borrow $6 trillion this year, even though we only have $5 trillion coming in. Well, that $1 trillion that is not covered, that's the debt. That's the deficit. Okay, so each year, the amount of money that they borrow above the amount of money they take in is called the deficit. That is a yearly event, and it's separate each year, each fiscal year. So FY21 started in September of 2020 or wherever they started, September, October, somewhere in there. So they start the fiscal year, and anytime they spend more or borrow and spend more money than they take in, that adds to the deficit. The cumulative, the entire put together cumulative added deficits, plural, over all the years that they've incurred, deficits, represents the national debt. Okay, so the deficit is what happens yearly. The national debt is what happens cumulatively. Okay, now we've had a national debt for a long time. I got Pianki in the line. I'm going to get you just a second here. So the national debt started, I think, back at our founding. And the national debt was minuscule because the government was minuscule. It was actually funded by duties. You know, in other words, imports coming in fund government. There was no tax until 1913, no income tax, right? So it wasn't until the the progressives came in and they had a progressive tax to start income tax. Oh, don't worry, it's only going to affect the top, 1% of the population. Yeah, sure. And so it accumulates. Now, Calvin Coolidge, my personal hero as presidents go, cut the national debt in half. And the way he did it was he cut federal spending in half over the course of his term, and that's what gave us the Roaring Twenties. So if you want the Roaring Twenties again, you have to do the same thing. And I begged Trump to do it, and I wish I could have talked to him personally. I said, look, President dude, if you want to go down in history as great as Calvin Coolidge, then you got to cut the federal spending in half. You got to veto budgets until Congress, kicking and screaming, after however many shutdowns, gives you a budget that is half what it is now. You'll be a hero. You take the surplus from that, and you put it towards the national debt, and you start paying the thing off. I'll explain how we do that a little bit more. I did it once before earlier this week, but I'll give you a brief synopsis again. In the meantime, let's get Pianki on, and let's talk about the debt. Pianki, welcome to the show. Welcome to our Friday free-for-all.
I think that – and good morning, James. I think that people don't understand when you talk about deficit and when you talk about debt.
Is that a fairly decent explanation, or do you think I should elaborate on something?
Well, let me see. The fiscal year for the United States ends on September the 30th.
Okay.
Just like with some businesses, fiscal year don't have to end on April the 15th. It can go out further into the year.
Okay.
So.
Got it. Yeah.
If you figure that you're going to make $50,000, and make it simple, and you have to be able to budget that $50,000, spend what you budget to spend, and if you break even on September the 30th, well, that was a good year. But if sometime in between your income doesn't come in and you have to borrow, and at the end of September the 30th, you have spent, say, $55,000, well, you got a $5,000 deficit.
Right.
And then that deficit is carried into a debt, into the debt column on accounting. So you carry the debt into the next year until you can recover it. So what we have here now, we got some numbers that's going to be unrecoverable because the total revenue of the United States, the last time I looked, it was about $3 trillion or $3.5 trillion.
And gross domestic product? Let's ask Gene to look up. I'm going to ask Gene to look up the gross domestic product, and let's find out how much it is.
Find out the
interest on the national debt. And then the defense budget. So I got three questions, Gene. If you want to write these down, the interest on the national debt, the defense budget for the most recent year you can find, and what was the third thing we're looking up?
Gene, you can see that on a website called Debt Clock, DebtClock. It's right up to the moment, and you can also go back into years and see what it was years ago. But Debt Clock is one of the best that you can see. Then also, people don't understand that debt is apportioned amongst U.S. citizens.
Yeah, well, actually, I think we've talked a lot about, you might have missed some of the earlier chat we had this hour, that we've talked a lot about that. The debts, the Treasury, you know, parcels out the debt, Treasury bonds, Treasury bills, people actually invest in those, but that requires interest. And so people have to pay for, the government has to pay for the privilege of borrowing money, and they do that is they pay interest. And when times are tight, they have to pay more interest to attract people to buy those bonds. China owns a bunch of them. You know, our debt is owned mostly by the American people, which is kind of ironic, but the richest American people, foundations, corporations, investors, you know, those are the folks that own the debt. And so we are actually ending up paying ourselves.
Well,
it doesn't matter, the money has to be paid.
Yeah, the reason why, and that's on a greater level, but individually, if the U.S. debt is $100 million, then you had 100 million people in the country, you know, each person technically owe a million toward this debt.
No, actually, this is what I disagree with. We don't owe it because we didn't incur the expense. Now, they may put it on the American taxpayer to pay it back, but we didn't borrow the money.
Yeah, but regardless, if you look at that debt block and how it's dispersed, regardless, if you didn't physically say yeah, you still part of it because you're part of it.
Oh, I know we're part of it. I know we're going to get settled with it. But here's the thing, too. If you go back to the Coolidge example of cutting the federal budget in half and the national debt in half, it can be done. It was done. And they screamed at him just as much then as they're going to scream at Trump in 2024 that you can't do this. You can't cut our spending. You can't stop the spigot. And these people, there's a blind obsession and a complete denial that's going on too. We can bring Gene back on this, but there's a denial. There's a denial that they think this can go on forever, or they're just hoping it doesn't crash during their term. So in other words, they keep raising the debt.
Okay.
Well, we got away with this. If we got away with this, maybe we can do it next year. Hold on, Gene, just a second. We can get further and further. We can just keep raising it because we don't see any consequences. You know, we got $20 trillion, then we got $30 trillion, and maybe we'll go to $50 trillion, and maybe we'll somewhere along the way, I think it's going to collapse. It has to. But that's what I think these people are so obsessed with borrowing that their likability factor and their elections depend on them spending ever more money. And that's where I think the obsession is the real – this is a psychological problem as much as it is a money problem. Gene, what you got?
Okay, now hold on just a second. It keeps changing a little bit.
Well, it's okay. Do whatever
–
you know,
snapshots
are good.
It,
yeah.
What I can see is $28,430,876,607.
Well, the rest of it keeps moving too fast.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah. And then what I found for the military budget is $715 billion.
Okay. The interest on the national debt.
Let me get the interest on the national debt.
Okay. So that was the $738 billion. What's that?
Pardon me?
So $738 billion was the military, right? Hold on.
$715, yes.
$15 billion.
So,
okay, so that's the military.
Let me see if I can figure out the
interest. All right, now we'll get the interest. Yeah, I think the interest now exceeds the entire military budget.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
So if they want to spend $5 trillion on the Green New Deal and infrastructure, that's actually more than five times our entire national defense budget. And the defense budget, under a constitutional budget, which I've talked about before, I'll do briefly again, the defense budget is most of it. So a constitutional budget is like $1 trillion, to about $1.5 trillion, depending on how you do things. So is the interest in the national debt on the debt clock? I don't know if it's there.
No, I found a different one. Let me see. Okay.
Instant response radio. Go ahead, Yankee.
I say go to usdebtclock.org. It's
you
a virtual
figure?
Running clock.
Okay.
Well,
the debt is $28.9 trillion. The revenue for the U.S. is $3.9 trillion.
That's what I want.
Per citizen, the debt per citizen is $228,999. Every citizen of the country owe that much per taxpayer. Per citizen, that's man, woman, child, no matter how young and old you are, is about $87,000.
See, but that's not a good comparison because people pay taxes at different rates. And that doesn't count corporate taxes or anything else. Hold on just a sec, please. I'm sorry. That's not real – to divide up with every person isn't quite real because there's so many different income levels. Most people don't even pay tax. It's like over like 50, 51% of the people don't pay any tax at all. If you take the mortgage interest deduction and you take the standard deduction, a couple of other things, most people don't earn enough money to pay taxes, and they don't realize that. So they keep saying, I'm a taxpayer. Well, no, you're not. You know, unless you make over a certain income. Most of the taxes are paid, you know, 1% pays like 50% of taxes and 10% pays like 90%. And then, you know, the next 40% pays the rest. And people, you know, under a certain threshold, most people don't pay any tax at all. So that's not really a legitimate comparison, I don't think. Anyway, Gene, to you.
Hold on, Piaki.
And I don't know, it says over the next 10 years without any changes, and I don't know when this was written, but they said that the interest, the net interest will total $5.4 trillion. And then in 2031, interest costs would account for 12% of the entire federal budget.
Yeah, that's wild. Do you know what the interest is now? I'm trying to compare the military budget, the debt, and the interest on the debt together. So current interest is what? That's what I want to find out. How much was paid last year, last fiscal year, whatever, on interest, just interest alone on the national debt? Because we've got $715 billion for the military. We've got revenue of $3.9 trillion, and they're spending, you know. Well, you can find how much they spent in the last one, too. I mean, I probably should have had these figures ahead. I wasn't planning to do this because I got a couple of articles I haven't even gotten to. And I want to get to those before we get Derek at 7:30. Pianchi, back to you.
Well, the unfunded liability is $158 trillion.
Okay. Yeah, see, I don't know how they even calculate that because there's so many different things to it that at some point I think people get turned off and I get turned off, and I love the numbers, you know, but I even think some of these are not quite relevant to where we're going with this. But it is insane. It is truly insane what is happening. I think there's kind of an insanity in Washington, or it's either a self-delusion that they think this can keep going, or that their elections they think are dependent on it, or they're just hoping it doesn't, you know, crash during the time they're in office, or all of the above. You know, they say, well, let me do my 4 years and get my pension, and you know, I'll get out of here. But it's very crazy. And the $3.9 trillion is not what it was. When I originally figured my constitutional budget 3 or 4 years ago, it was $4.5 trillion. So the federal government has lost an incredible amount of money. Now, one would think it's like when somebody loses a job or gets a huge cut in income or a demotion or any of the things, or a reorganization in a different company, and you get your salary cut. Most people cut their expenses. Congress, when they get a salary cut, or not a salary personally, but in other words, when Congress gets a revenue cut, they don't care. They're just spending rolling right along at the same level. It's fascinating how this is all working out. All right, I'm going to go to Gene and Pianchi. Each of you guys get a quick comment. I want to start my first
article. Military is spending $733 billion.
Okay.
The Gene interest on U.S. debt is $406 billion.
$406 billion?
$406 billion, $433,170,000, and then the clock is
and
running.
That's for fiscal year what? What's that fiscal year? Is that this year?
Well, yeah, that's this fiscal year. That's fiscal year 2021.
Okay, so they got $406 billion on the national debt, $715 on the military. They got $3.9 trillion in revenue, $29 trillion national debt. Okay, deficit for this year? Do we know what that is? Let's get all our numbers out here. This is kind of, you guys are great. I really appreciate you doing this research as I'm trying to figure where I want to go next. So the deficit.
Wasn't that 28 trillion something?
No, that's the national debt. I want the yearly deficit. What was the last fiscal year? So it wouldn't be this year because we don't know what the deficit is. They're still borrowing money. They just raised the debt ceiling another $500 billion. So that'll put the debt ceiling about the national debt about $29.5 trillion. With that extra $500 billion, they just voted for themselves. So what is the deficit this year, the fiscal year 2020 deficit? Because 2021 is not over. So what was the deficit, the federal deficit in fiscal year 2020? That's the next figure. While we're looking at that, let me start an article here. And this is by Larry D. Spears. And the article, the website is called Money Morning, as in money, M-O-N-E-Y, Money Morning. And it says, we make investing profitable. Well, that is the idea. And so it's interesting that I had to go back to 2011 to find articles where they actually complained and realistically, you know, said that you shouldn't be increasing the debt. Now, this is during the Obama term, because Obama's the one that raised, I think, $2 trillion, the national debt. Everybody was horrified. It went from like, what did it go from, $10 trillion to $12 trillion? And that to me, that seems now it's like pocket change, you know, compared to what they're doing. But I want this article is fairly short, but I think it tells you a thing. And I was searching for articles, you know, more current. Well, it's fascinating. There aren't any. So you want to talk about the control of information. The control of information is so bad, you can't find hardly any. I found one. Current. No, actually, that was back from 2011 also. You go ahead, do a search. Anybody want to do a search? Go ahead. Pianki, you got a minute? Do a search. Look for an article saying curb the debt ceiling, lower the debt ceiling. You know, if you do, you get the Mises article. That's the one I have next. But holding the debt ceiling, you know, don't raise the debt ceiling. And, of course, all the search engine will see is raise the debt ceiling, and you get about 50 articles. You know, that's about where I stopped looking, that all talk about raising the debt ceiling. There's nobody even talking, except for us, there's nobody currently talking about lowering the debt ceiling, let alone holding it even. Let me start this article.
The U.S. painful, debt in 2016. Deficit. Right at $20 trillion.
Yeah, I want the deficit. I want the yearly deficit, or how much money did they borrow above how much they spent for fiscal year 2020. So you got to use the word deficit, or you're not going to.
U.S. federal spending in 2016 is right at $3.9 trillion.
Okay, and what was the
federal budget deficit was $590 billion in 2016.
Okay, so they borrowed
$670.
All right, give me those numbers one more time. I think you're onto something here. So what was the first number you gave?
The U.S. debt in 2016. They used to break it down year by year, but it's hard to keep up with now.
No kidding. So 20 trillion in 2016.
The U.S. debt.
Okay.
20 trillion.
Okay, what was the next number?
The next number was the U.S. federal tax revenue is $3.3 trillion.
Okay.
U.S. federal spending is $3.9 trillion.
Okay.
The budget deficit was $590 billion in 2016.
Okay, so now you see the pattern, all right? So the debt, 4 years ago, the debt was $20 trillion. Now it's approaching $30
trillion.
So
$608 billion was defense in that year.
$680 billion?
$608 billion.
Okay. So what that shows me is that the military budget was only slightly above the deficit. So they spent almost as much, they borrowed almost as much money as they spent to defend the whole nation. And that includes, you know, 400 foreign bases and all the other stuff that they spend money on. Fascinating. They spent $3.9 trillion. They took in $3.3 trillion. And the debt obviously was added to. But what's interesting is 2016, the debt was $20 trillion. And now it's approaching $30 trillion. And we're only 5 years later. That should scare the hell out of you, because it took our entire history to get it to $20
trillion. It projects in 2025 that the U.S. national debt will be $49 trillion.
Okay. And the reason and the way that we stop this, you know, one of the ways is that we start a movement. And of course, it won't catch on, but I have to try to take away Congress's power to borrow money. That's the first thing. Now, the simple solution.
The interest on the debt.
Okay, enough numbers. Okay, I'm done with numbers. I don't want to hear any more numbers. I mean, I'm not criticizing you. I want to cover some different stuff here. And so, yeah, so we could do these numbers all day. Numbers they already are staggering. So the question is, what do we do about it? Now, the simple solution that I outlined, I made a video and I've written an article, and I've talked about, I devoted a whole show to this, to a constitutional budget. In other words, you take Article 1, Section 8, which is the only things that the federal government is allowed to spend money on, which of course they exceed. And then you go by that. If you go by that, your cost per year is about $1 to $1.5 trillion. Okay. If they take in $3.3 trillion. Well, the last one was, revenue is $3.9 trillion. Okay. So if they take in, let's just make it simple. If they take in $4 trillion, worst case scenario on the constitutional budget, they spend $1.5. That's $2.5 trillion surplus. Well, if you put $2.5 trillion surplus into the national debt, you know, you take off a little bit. You take off quite a bit. Well, the minute you do that, your interest costs lower the next year. So you could have a greater surplus, assuming that you you know, maintain that constitutional budget of $1.5 trillion. If the government only spent $1.5 trillion, the economy would boom beyond your wildest dreams. That would generate so much more money and so much more tax money. The federal coffers would probably be $5, $6, $7, $8 trillion of revenue, simply because the even with lower taxes, because the economic activity would be so great, they'd have a lot extra money. So say you had a $5 trillion surplus that year. So now all of a sudden you take your $7 trillion and you pay off $5 trillion of that. Now you're $22 trillion in debt. Well, the next year you're going to even have a bigger boom. But you notice nobody ever does those projections. If we actually start, living within a constitutional budget, which is what I'm proposing, we could pay this off probably 10 years, with a little bit of discipline, especially if you remove the power of Congress to borrow money. I believe that's really the key now. You take away their power to borrow money because obviously they can't handle it. That's what you do. Let me start this article here. I think you're going to find this interesting. And again, Gene, if you want to hit the hotel bell or Pianki, just yell at me. I'll stop and I'll get this out here. It's the article again, Larry D. Spears, Painful Consequences of a Debt Ceiling Increase from Money Morning. And this is July 18th of 2011. But don't worry, folks, the problems are still the same. They haven't changed one bit. Failure to reach a compromise on a U.S. debt ceiling increase could result in an unmitigated economic disaster, one so unprecedented government and private analysts can't even accurately pinpoint all the potential consequences. To avert this crisis, U.S. President Barack Obama, and that's an alleged term, that's me talking, wants a debt ceiling increase of $2 trillion, which analysts say would carry the country through the end of 2012. The president has moved the deadline for reaching an agreement up to July 22nd. See, everything here is movable. This is what makes it so fascinating. President Obama, I choke on those words, said the time cushion was needed to prevent a last-minute panic by the financial and debt markets that could, quote, potentially create another recession. Shit. What do you think spending does? Anyway, panicking investment possibly causing an economic meltdown even worse than the one in 2008. But even after a debt ceiling increase is approved, though it would obviously produce a brief sigh of collective fiscal relief, the U.S. economy, here's where it gets good, the U.S. economy and markets will suffer painful effects and almost no longer-term positive impact. So what can investors expect once the U.S. debt limit is in fact raised? What do you think so far? I always like to stop for comments partway through these articles.
I have no comments.
Okay. Pianki, I know you're going to jump in when you have something. Next section, higher rates and inflation. Okay, here's the bad news, right? The prospect that the country will be able to add $2 trillion to its tab over the next 18 months is unlikely to make potential lenders, in other words, buyers of Treasury securities, jump with joy. Just ask your credit card companies for a 13.98% increase in your borrowing limits, assuring them you'll use every bit of it and see what it does to your credit score. This is what we talked about. So you bring it to a personal level. So what they asked for then was a 13.98% increase in the national debt. That's incredible. The article says this means a debt ceiling increase is likely to lead to a downgrade of the U.S. credit rating, which will cause investors to demand higher rates to compensate for the increased risk. That's where your interest on the national debt gets bigger. And because it costs more money, costs more because we're shakier ground. Then it says to gauge just how much higher, JP Morgan Chase & Company recently surveyed its clients to see what they thought. According to the Washington Post, a reliable source, respondents from within the United States told the bank they expected rates to rise by 0.37%, but foreign investors who hold about half of outstanding U.S. debt, you get that, folks? Foreign investors hold about half of outstanding U.S. debt, predicted a rise of 0.5% or more just to get more money. 0.5%, well, it's only 0.5%. No, when you talk about the entire economy, that's a massive amount of money. He says a rate increase of that size would boost U.S. interest payments on new debt by more than $7.5 billion a year. The cost of rolling over existing debt at those rates could rise by as much as $71 billion a year. And there's no guarantee the increase would be short-lived. When a combination of similar events forced a two-week delay in U.S. debt payments in 1979, a study conducted 10 years later found it had caused interest rates to rise by an average of 0.6% for more than 5 years. More borrowing and higher interest rates also will mean more inflation, which is what we really don't need right now because we already have rampant inflation. This is going to create more inflation. All right. After all, the article says, even if the Republicans in Congress back down and allow some federal tax increases, there's no way those being discussed will be enough to cover the increased debt burden or even the increased interest payments. So the only way the U.S. can pay the increased interest, forget about principal, is to print more money. That means a weaker, devalued dollar and higher prices for everything priced in dollars. So this borrowing, this raising the debt ceiling, this is why I say they're not solving a debt crisis, they're causing one. Okay. So by borrowing more money, they're actually causing a crisis throughout our entire economy, which is why I call it economic treason and economic suicide. Comments on that? Then I'll move on to the next section. You don't have to. I always like to just sort of stop and check in with you guys.
No comment. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be really tough because between 2021 and 2025, mm-hmm. I think you're looking at the median price of a house is about $360, and 2025 is going to be $480, and the workforce is going to decrease.
Well, see, that's why I bring in a million illegal aliens. They can take those jobs, the jobs that Americans don't want to do, he said, laughing his ass off. Yeah, yeah, we're being replaced. See, the problem with these predictions is there's such an easy way to change that, you know. And like I say, we start adopting some things that I'm talking about, and I'm going to start a campaign. Like I say, as this show grows and as we get bigger and bigger, you know, we're going to start to talk about a constitutional amendment to remove the borrowing power of Congress. We're going to talk about a constitutional budget. If it isn't in Article 1, Section 8, you can't spend money on it, and that means all the entitlements. Okay, I do want to take the federal budget to the Supreme Court and get an opinion. You know, and the opinion is so obvious, they don't have a, you know, intellectually, they don't have a choice because the federal government does exceed Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. The federal budget is unconstitutional, which I want to put them in a box and say, okay, you know it's unconstitutional. Let's see what you're going to do. You know, and if they try and weasel out of it, then that'll be another burden. And people will go, wait a minute, this is unconstitutional. Why is the Supreme Court not saying it's unconstitutional? That's when it gets interesting. Back to the article. Beware the market's reaction. If or when the debt ceiling is increased, both stock and bond markets are likely to celebrate for a minute. Then, they'll re-examine the longer-term effects and turn sharply lower, perhaps extending the slide for quite a while. That's called a recession, folks. That possibility, back to the article, was demonstrated quite clearly back in the spring when following S&P, that's Standard & Poor's, April 18th decision to downgrade the outlook for U.S. debt to negative from stable. I wonder what it is now. The stock market's extended rally quickly stalled out, and the major averages began a six-week slide. That drop carried the Dow Jones Industrial Average from 12,807 to 11,897 from May 2nd to June 15th. We're talking about a month, about 6 weeks. Now the stock market is notoriously fickle, which it proved when the Dow then rallied back to 12,719 on July 7th. Okay, but then dropped 202 points the last Monday and Tuesday, choosing to ignore President Obama's debt assurances and instead focusing on the growing European sovereign debt crisis and S&P's threat to lower its ratings. That gets a little more, that's more, you know, noodly economic stuff. But here's where the last little bit here I want to get to is when they talk about starting a never-ending cycle. Okay, the acrimonious debate we're seeing over a debt ceiling increase likely will exacerbate the political divide in Washington, making the federal government gridlock even worse than it has been. This is exactly true today. Nothing's changed. This is what's so staggering about this. This article could have been written yesterday. All you do is change the numbers. Right? Article says, in fact, it's almost reached the point where the fight is more important than the issue itself. Yeah, no kidding. So what are the Republicans saying? Well, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling. The Democrats can raise it on their own. You know, they've got the votes. So in other words, what they're saying is we want to blame the Democrats when the economy crashes. But we're not going to stop it because we get to blame them. That's their virtue. That's their virtue point. That's their virtue signal. We get to blame the Democrats if things go wrong rather than saying we are responsible enough to stop the Democrats cold. That's what they should be saying, but they're not doing it. So they're sort of doing the right thing kind of for the wrong reason. The reason is political. We can make them look bad. All right. That's what they're trying to do. And then they wimp out to them when it comes to elections and let their elections be stolen. So what's the point? Geldings. Back to the article. Such a series of political standoffs, log jams, and other major inactions brings the final major consequence arising from this conflict. The prospect that we'll see a debt ceiling increase again and again and again. And guess what's happened? That's exactly what's happened. Every time they raise the debt ceiling, they make it easier to raise the debt ceiling. It's like serial killers. After you kill the first person, I mean, you know, what's three or four more, right? Okay. I mean, I hate to be so cold and blunt about it, but that's true. They become desensitized to raising the debt ceiling because they don't see the consequences. They only see the virtues of more spending. More people like them. They bring home more bacon to the districts. If you can spend $1 trillion, why can't you spend $5 trillion? If you can borrow, you know, $10 trillion, why can't you borrow $30? I mean, what's the difference? It's just a number on paper, right? No. The current request is for $2 trillion increase, only enough to allow the government to keep borrowing until the end of 2012. This is the article again. Under the president's proposed budget for fiscal 2012, the level of publicly held debt will rise from $10.4 trillion at the end of 2011 to $13.2 trillion at the end of 2012. And borrowing by 2013 will require lifting the debt ceiling again. What's more, the upward debt spiral will increase no matter what we do. With spending at current levels, the public debt will grow from today's $10.4 billion, roughly 69% of gross domestic product, that's GDP, to $20.8 trillion, or 87% of GDP. Now, listen, I want to go over this just for a second. So this is what they're projecting back in 2011. With spending at current levels, the public debt will grow from $10.4 trillion, which is 69% of gross domestic product. In other words, that's what our economy produces. The gross domestic product is what the economy produces, 69%. 20.8. Start again, Greg. Spending at current levels, public debt will go. Yeah, so the debt is $10.4 trillion, 69% of the gross domestic product, to $20.8 trillion, or 87% of GDP. So if $20.8 trillion is 87% of GDP, what is $30 trillion? So that's a question for Gene. I got to send you back to the computer, please, if I can. What is the current gross domestic product, and what percentage does the national debt represent now? Let's find out. So let's find out how much the gross domestic product is. We can probably calculate this ourselves. Let's find out what the gross domestic product is, and let's see. And then we know the debt is. We'll just say $30 trillion to make, you know, things simple. Let's find out what percentage that is. Bianca, do you know?
In 2025, it'd be 177.14%. The federal debt to the gross domestic product ratio.
Where'd you get that?
Messed up.
You're doing good numbers. You got some good numbers there. So this is – all right, so let's. So that's 2025. That's a projection. What's it now? Because have we –
Right now, it's 125.95%.
Say that again. How much is it? 100, what?
125.95%.
Let's just say
125%. The ratio of debt to gross domestic product.
So the national debt.
In other words, your debt is 25.9, almost 26% more than what you're producing in this country.
I want to let that kind of hang out there for a little bit for folks to listen to that very, very carefully. See, I knew it was close, but I didn't know it had exceeded. So, I'm not good with numbers, so I try and stay away from them. But I want you to think about this as a concept that we now owe more money than we produce every year. Okay, that is economic suicide. That is economic treason. If you owe more than you produce, you know that's that'd be like someone who what's the average salary? $35,000 a year. So that'd be like owing what? 25% over that.
The average medium income is about $35,000. In 2025, it will not change that much. It'd still be about $35,000.
Okay, I'm looking for my calculator. Hang on. Where am I? Here we go. Found it. All right. So let's go. $35,000.
The median income is $35,671.
So $43,750 is what it would be. You know, times 120%, basically times 25%. So it'd be like owing $43,000 when you only make $35,000. That's unsustainable. That's insane. And then, of course, that doesn't count the interest on top of that. That's just a percentage that we're over. Okay. A little bit more to read here. We're almost done. this is getting depressing. It says, what's more, the upwards, oh, I already read that. So, okay. The impact of the debt service on the economy also will inflict damage, reducing the amount of money available for new investment and growth and resulting in an annual drop in GDP of 0.7% or 3.8% of the total by 2021. So there you go. So just the debt that they incurred in 2010 or 2011, the debt that they incurred, the $2 trillion that they incurred in 2011, has a cumulative effect of 3.8% of the total by 2021, okay, annual drop in GDP. So we're losing money. We're losing our GDP. So not only are we increasing our debt, we're correspondingly losing the amount that the economy produces because more and more money is going to debt. Do you see the empty black hole that we're walking into willingly? And all the media and all the pundits and all the economists and all the politicians and all the corporate heads and the bankers, they're all saying increase the debt ceiling. Do you see how insane this is? Do you see how just completely bizarre? This makes the Twilight Zone, you know, the Twilight Zone was supposed to be a fantasy, not an agenda. as Jonathan Mosley said yesterday of the progressive left, 1984, you know, was a warning, not a manual. You know, and so this is where we are right now. And this is how nations destroy themselves. They destroy themselves politically by becoming totalitarian. They destroy themselves economically with debt, you know, and central control. And we can still stop this, but we've got to act fast. And then there's a lot of things that have to be done. And what my simple solution is that we the people need to start writing some new laws and saying to the government, this is how we consent to be governed. If you want to come back to office, then you will abide by our consent. And again, we're still stuck with the same problem that freedom has to be imposed. In other words, for all of us to be free, we have to make everybody else free too. And so that's what a republic really does. I mean, it's a dirty little secret, but freedom is imposed. Freedom is imposed by taking away democracy, because left to a pure democracy, this is what happens. You know, this is why the senators have to be elected by the states. This is why, you know, the census has to only include American citizens, not everybody that's walking across the border. This is why, you know, you need, you know, rules, laws, and the Constitution actually has to be in effect. If the Constitution were in effect, we wouldn't have a national debt, because you wouldn't have all these entitlements. You wouldn't have all these problems. So the answer, as usual, is to go back to the Constitution, go by a constitutional budget of Article 1, Section 8. Everything else goes to the states, and the states can choose. And most states can't borrow money. So we never would have gotten into this situation if Congress couldn't borrow money. You know, and the if Congress couldn't borrow money, I mean, let's put it that, and Congress wouldn't write an unconstitutional budget. Bianchi.
Well, it's very thin. Your student debt is going to increase from 40,000 to 50,000 in the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And that's a self-imposed problem. I worked my way through college. You know, the answer is, well, we got to pay the student debt so the students don't go broke. No. The answer is the students either don't take on the debt or don't go to college. See, nobody ever looks at the alternative. They have one answer. Students have to go to college. Therefore, we have to find a way to pay for it. Nonsense. Considering the state of colleges, I think most people should not go. Unless you're into a specific profession, medical, legal, engineering, you know, science, stuff like that. Things that, you know, English, if you want to, you know, I mean, if you're really going there for something very specific, that makes sense. But in terms of general, just everybody going just for the sake of going, you know, no, it doesn't make any sense at all. And if you can't pay for it, don't go. And the government should be out of the student loan business. All right, last little bit here. Of course, all these possibilities pale beside the outlook should Congress and President Obama fail to reach an agreement to increase the debt ceiling. Well, that's interesting. The impact of even a one-month suspension of Social Security and Medicare payments, one proposed temporary fix, would surely cripple the economy and collapse the markets. And anything worse could be the gateway to a new recession or even depression. Be prepared for the debt ceiling to increase by examining your areas of highest financial vulnerability and engaging in defensive investing. Well, this is interesting. Take some steps to hedge your risks using such investment tools as options, inverse ETFs, or precious metals. In other words, buy gold. This is interesting. All right, anyway. So I found that article quite fascinating. I had, but I don't want to talk about it anymore. There we go. So just comments. What do you all think? Curious? Sound familiar? Delusion? Where are we?
If food stamps recipient will increase by 14 million in the next 4 years. Go ahead.
So you got the numbers. This is great. You should, you know, feel free to put these numbers on the show anytime you want. We don't have to have a specific topic, but if you have a comparison, you got some things like this. That'd be wonderful just to get these because, you know, as much as I'm not good with numbers, I can see what the patterns are. And so that's very interesting. I think it was established that this is unsustainable, to use the leftist term.
Your median income would go from $35,000 to $37,000 in the next mm-hmm. 4 years.
That's nothing. That's $500 a year. That's not an increase. And okay, no, wait. Now let's throw in inflation. Let's throw in 5% inflation, which is what it is right now. So if you lose 5% a year of that $500, so $35,000. What's 5% of $35,000? 10% would be $3,500. So half of that would be $1,750, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so your $35,000 salary with 5% inflation reduces it by $750, even though your increase is $500. So you're at a deficit of $250. Okay. So with 5% inflation, you actually lose more money than the money you're making. So you're actually losing money every year because of inflation. You want to talk about a tax on the working class, on the working people? That's your tax, folks. Okay. So inflation is taking away the rate of inflation is now greater than the rate of your salary increases. What do you think of that? What do you think of them apples, as they say? Gene, you want to get into this?
The deficit with China will increase by $46
billion. Deficit where?
The U.S.-China deficit. The U.S. trade deficit with China will increase by $46 billion. In other words, we're going to get $46 billion more from them than what we are presently doing.
Oh, so you're saying
you know the
deficit...
thing about this?
Wait, hold on. The China deficit is in our favor now?
No, it's going to be in their favor. Right now, it's $339 billion. In 4 more years, it's going to go up to like $446 billion.
See, now wasn't Trump with tariffs actually changing that? So we actually had a surplus with China. The trade deficit was on their side. Well, of course, Biden.
Yes.
You know, the Chinese ambassador. I should start calling him the Chinese ambassador Biden from the Communist Party. That's really what he is. Yeah. Okay. I want to play something. Gene, do you have another comment for a start or Santa Rosa Volunteers piece for today?
No. I just think it's staggering. It's like, wow.
That's actually a great comment.
Tell Gene
that's
put me in the green room.
Say that again, Pianki? I'm sorry. I interrupted you.
Tell Gene to put me in the green room while you play on your commercial.
you can do that. I tell you, okay, all right, yeah. So go into the screening room. We'll see you guys later. I'm gonna play some stuff. And I just made this yesterday. Actually, this took several days because I really want to get into the Federalist Papers more and more and sort of dig into this. And this is our sponsor, Santa Rosa Volunteers. Let me play this for you, and we'll be back in a few minutes. I hope you enjoy it. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents. Sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers, here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. We now leave the tepid and vapid John Jay for someone far better known, yet equally contemptible, for lying to the American people, for bringing up the boogeyman of what might happen as a reason to move from the Articles of Confederation during a time when the states were probably their most united after our war for independence against Great Britain, where there is no such evidence of an actual split of the Confederation of States into the 3 to 4 independent confederacies so described over and over by the Federalists. In other words, it's the same old story. Scare the people away from something good to something worse, when that worse benefits you. Ironically, it is under the Constitution that the states broke into the Confederacy in the mid-1800s that led to the Civil War. There is no way to know if such would have happened under the Articles of Confederation. I've searched the internet and cannot find any instance where any one or more groups of states formed their own confederations against the other states or against the new federal government under the Articles of Confederation. Alexander Hamilton, who wrote Federalist No. 6, is far more intellectual and therefore far more persuasive than John Jay. Hamilton unfortunately still uses the same framework of arguing against something that doesn't exist while trying to sell a solution because it might happen, maybe, with that solution being an entirely new constitution where no one knows if or how it would work. Ironically, the Constitution actually ends up allowing for the same abuses of power that it allegedly was created to prevent, and that it causes over time the very problems Hamilton said would not happen if they repealed the Articles of Confederation. In a prescient paragraph, Hamilton, while trying to sell what will not happen, outlines exactly what has happened over time under the Constitution. He begins, "The causes of hostility among nations are innumerable. There are some which have a general and almost constant operation upon the collective bodies of society. Of this description are the love of power or the desire of preeminence and dominion, the jealousy of power or the desire of equality and safety. There are others which have a more circumscribed, though an equally operative influence within their spheres. Such are the rivalships and competitions of commerce between commercial nations, and there are others, not less numerous than either of the former, which take their origin entirely in private passions, in the attachments, enmities, interests, hopes, and fears of leading individuals in the communities of which they are members. Men of this class, whether the favorites of a king or of a people, have in too many instances abused the confidence they possessed, and assuming the pretext of some public motive, have not scrupled to sacrifice the national tranquility to personal advantage or personal gratification." Much of this should ring true. Dr. Anthony Fauci, whom we affectionately call Dr. Fascist here at Action Radio, is the preeminent example of this personal, pathological power and wealth, decadency, and obsession. Alexander Hamilton then goes through a bunch of examples of corruption, greed, and despotism in countries that were monarchies or otherwise centrally controlled as relevant and comparable to our unique Confederation of States, which were probably the most decentralized of any nation. They weren't relevant comparisons, but he tried to make that argument anyway, and made it the basis of his, "we better ratify the Constitution or that scenario will happen," argument. But without any prediction of the actual breakdown into those 3 to 4 factions and what those factions might be, it's speculation at best, propaganda at worst. Hamilton also says, "So far is the general sense of mankind from corresponding with the tenets of those who endeavor to lull asleep our apprehensions of discord and hostility between the states in the event of disunion, that it has from long observation of the progress of society become a sort of axiom in politics, that vicinity or nearness of situation constitutes nations' natural enemies. An intelligent writer expresses himself on this subject to this effect." Okay, paragraph break here. He is saying that because the states are next to each other, conflict is only a matter of time. And then he tries to tie his false premise, invalid comparisons, and made-up conclusions all together with an exasperated expression of the futility of human nature. And so it's all going to fall apart anyway. Unless you follow him and the Federalists into the Constitution. He says, finishing the paragraph, "Neighboring nations are naturally enemies of each other unless their common weakness forces them to league into a confederate republic, and their constitution prevents the differences that neighborhood occasions, extinguishing that secret jealousy which disposes all states to aggrandize themselves at the expense of their neighbors. This passage, at the same time, points out the evil and suggests the remedy." Okay. So how does this suggest the remedy exactly? Call me crazy, but it appears the Federalists are arguing for the Constitution without actually using the Constitution in their arguments. No provisions of the Constitution have been gone over. No provisions have been highlighted as examples of how to prevent the very descending into chaos they so fervently argue will happen without the Constitution. I'm guessing the people of this time were as confused as I am today. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from foundingfathersquotes.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. Dangerously cool. I just love that. It brings us all back here. So, yeah. So, Gene, I hope you had a nice chat with Bianchi. this is going to be great, Gene. If you get more powerful than me, I probably shouldn't put on the basis, but just the idea, that's great. So, anybody wants to talk to Gene, just, you know, call up, request to talk to Gene. You guys can go on the screen.
He talked to me about a website to look at. Yeah, the website.
Okay. No, you don't have to disclose. I mean, I'm perfectly fine with this. I just think it's kind of funny. This is the first time this happened, actually. I want to talk to Gene. Yeah, go away, Greg. Okay. Cracks me up. Anyway, I want to get back to the article here, another article that I found, and it's kind of funny. This I found this morning, and so I'm looking around because, you know, it takes you a long time to search through to find something. You got to ask the right question if you want to get the correct results. If you just look up debt ceiling, you know, you're always going to get the articles to raise it. And I finally found one by simply putting in lower the debt ceiling, and then I got an article titled lower the debt ceiling, which is what I want. Now, ironically, it's written by Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute. Now, Mark Thornton's been on the show before, so I'm going to see if I can contact him and see if I can get him for next week. And so we'll talk. Mark is brilliant. He's a fascinating guy. So we only got a few minutes before Derek gets here to talk about, guess what, the economy. We're kind of saturating you with the economy today. But I'm going to start the article where he starts off what we really need. And again, this is 2011. Okay, so this is another older article, 7/15/2011. So July 15th, 2011, by Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute. That's M-I-S-E-S. That's Ludwig von Mises of the Austrian School of Economics. That's where it comes from. All right. He says here, what we really need to do is lower the debt ceiling. So there's two of us now. Two of us saying this, all right? He says, if Congress passed legislation that systematically reduced the debt ceiling over time, the economy could be rebuilt on a solid foundation. Entrepreneurs in the productive sectors would realize that an ever-increasing proportion of resources, land, labor, and capital, would be at their disposal, while companies that capitalize on the federal budget would have an ever-declining share of such resources. So all those companies living off the federal budget, okay, you parasites out there, you know, all you big contractors and defense people and everybody else that's screwing us over and doing the $600 toilets and all the other stuff that we know you're doing, okay, yeah, that would switch. The share that you would get would gradually reduce and should. That's one of our biggest problems is that the lobbyists, you know, take so much money from Congress that should be going just to the general investment, the actual free market. Okay, anyway, says entrepreneurs in the productive sectors would realize an ever-increasing proportion of resources. I think I said that already. There we go. I'm sorry. Congress would have to cut the pay and benefits of its employees. FDR cut them by 25% in the depths of the Great Depression, as well as the number of such employees. Real wage rates would decline, allowing entrepreneurs to hire more employees to produce consumer-valued goods. Yeah, so along with cutting the budget, we have to cut the size of government. And I would say just fire everybody over the age of 30 in the federal government because they're probably too corrupt. They've been there too long. And let's start over. Let's start over with a younger government force and limit them to 10 years. So the real term limits, I mean, nobody's talked about this either. The real term limits we need is not on Congress. It's on the bureaucracies. It's on the bureaucrats. It's on the people that spend 34 years. It's on the Dr. Fascists of the world that have been there, 50 years? He spent his entire life screwing people over from his powerful positions in government and killing hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, this is the ultimate expression of bureaucrat power is Dr. Fascist. All right. Back to the article. Congress would have to cut back on its far-flung regulatory operations. There we go. Which are, in fact, one of the biggest drags on the economy due to the burden and uncertainty that Obama and Congress have created in terms of health care, that'd be Obamacare, financial market, and environmental regulations. A recent study by the Phoenix Center found that even a small reduction of 5% or $2.8 billion in the federal regulatory budget would result in about a $75 billion in increased private sector GDP each year and the addition of 1.2 million jobs annually. Think about that, 5% reduction, $2.8 billion from federal regulatory budgets, and we get massive return. This is why the economy boomed under Trump, okay? Because Trump got rid of so many stupid regulations. And guess who brought him back? The usurper in chief, you know, the installed president, you know, China's ambassador to the United States, Joe Biden. This is why this is so staggering, all right? And it's just little changes can make huge differences, except the problem is that all the changes are going in the wrong direction. Mark goes on to say, under a reduced debt ceiling, the federal government would also have to sell off some of its resources. It has tens of thousands of buildings that are no longer in use and tens of thousands of buildings that are significantly underused. About, here you go, you ready for this? 75,000 buildings in total. It also controls over 400 million acres of land, or over 20% of all land outside of Alaska, which is almost wholly owned by the government. There is also the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and many other assets that could be sold off to cover short-term budget shortfalls. Okay, I like the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I think it'd be stupid to get rid of it. That seems short-sighted. You know, as free market as I am, it actually does some good. Trump filled that. The whole idea of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is that in times of, you know, economic embargoes, ridiculous price increases, we can actually lower the price by increasing the supply because we have a reserve just in case. Now, the best reserve, of course, is independent energy production. When Trump had us, you know, making energy and exporting it, we were exporting oil. We're exporting natural gas, you know, because we had so much of it, and we still have so much of it. The problem is that Thief in Chief Biden has locked it all up again, like Obama did, and sort of, you know, knuckled under to the environmental wackos that think carbon dioxide, in other words, plant oxygen, is somehow a pollutant. Hey, Gene, I got a question for you. This is totally off the wall. This struck me the other day that the limitation of CO2 should be put as a violation of the Endangered Species Act because we're restricting the carbon dioxide available for plants, just like territory, habitat, and everything else. Could we? I have to talk to Mosley about this, but is there a way? Let me ask you now just to start this process, but do you think there's a way to declare carbon dioxide as habitat or territory or essential for plants? Otherwise, you know, the plants are going to be endangered because they have a lack of carbon dioxide. Do you think that's something we could work on? I never thought about it, but I'm just curious.
Oh, man, it's not anything I ever thought about either. Wow.
Yeah, this is why you folks should all be glad you don't have my brain, because this happens to me all day long. Okay, so I'm going to write that down here and put a big star beside it. CO2 and the Endangered Species Act. Yeah, I love using the government against the government. Okay, that's my research project for this weekend. Can we use the Endangered Species Act to get rid of carbon dioxide restrictions because plants need that or they're going to go extinct? What's the difference between that and farmland that they take or a wetland? You know, somebody has a pond in their yard that some duck lands in. All of a sudden, that's a wetland, and they lose that property. Well, carbon dioxide is the same way as the property of plants. So you're taking away their property. You're taking away their habitat. They're taking away their every bit as much as anything else. I mean, it's a stretch, but who knows? Let me look up some environmental law. I actually took a course in that in college. All right, I think there's only just a little bit here. Here we go. Of course, reducing the debt ceiling would force the government to stop borrowing so much money from credit markets. This would leave significantly more credit available for the private sector. The shortage of capital is one of the most often cited reasons for the failure of the economy to recover. Yeah, there's no money. The cost of money is too much. And whatever the government takes away from the private sector, which is productive. Government does not produce wealth. Private sector produces wealth. Labor plus raw materials, you know, plus investment equals finished goods, which equal profit. In other words, taking the components and putting them together into something that's greater than the components by themselves. That's wealth. Simple definition. Okay, so passing an increase in the debt ceiling merely perpetuates the myth that there is any ceiling or control or limit on the government's ability to waste resources in the short run and its willingness to pass the burden of the squander onto future generations. And that's exactly what you were saying earlier. Wow. That's all I can say is wow. Oh boy. So there's one more voice. So at least, you know, I'm going to see if I can get Mark on the show. He's, like I said, he is brilliant. He's done some incredible things in his work. All right. I'm going to kind of vamp here until Derek joins us, which should be any time. Let me check Facebook real quick. Let's see if he sent me any messages. So, as far as I know. Okay. Yep. It should be on any minute now. Gene, anything strike your interest this week of things that really stand out as, I can't believe they did that, or any of those kind of things for you?
It's the same old, the hypocrisy of what's going on in Washington. They have these congressional hearings, and like, I don't even know why they do that, because nothing ever happens because of them. You know, it's just amazing.
I got a couple for you. And we got Bianchi in the line, too. Why talk to Bianchi? Sorry. Go ahead.
Just what's going on in Arizona. They're having talks out there, too.
As far as what goes, I think there's supposed to be a meeting.
Election.
I think the Maricopa County, in fact, I just heard this, you know, late last night, that the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors is actually going to have a public hearing of some kind early in November. Oh, boy. This could get really interesting. Yeah. Yeah. That's so we shall see what's going on with that. But the thing I was curious about, actually a couple of things that I was curious about, just a theoretical kind of thing. Well, let me make Pianchi's line. Let's bring him in unless he wants to talk to you. I'm never going to let you forget that. It was kind of funny. Actually, Derek's here right now too. So one of the things I was going to talk about was the fact that we really have two Americas, independent and compliant. The independent Americans are not getting the vaccine. They're not wearing the masks. They're rebelling. They're going to the school board meetings. They're being called domestic terrorists, and they're doing all those kind of things. And the compliant Americans
are
knuckling
me?
Under. Go ahead, Gene. What are you going to say, and then I'll bring on Derek?
I was going to say parents, domestic parents, terrorists, because they're looking out for their child's best interest.
Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that after Derek, and actually we're going to have a little time. We've got, if he can spend a few extra minutes with us. But Jim Dykes can't make it today. He'll be back next week, and then we're going to have Donnie Chappie Chapman joining us at 8:30, about an hour from now. So let's get Derek on. Money. What is it? How does it work? How do you get it to work for you? So many choices. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, commodities, and then there are the markets. Oil, gold, manufacturing, trade, energy, even government. To make sense of all the places your money can go, Derek Park of Edward Jones Financial Advisors joins us Fridays at this time to make sense of the markets and your money. Well, I'll tell you what, it's been a fascinating hour and a half. We've actually spent the whole time on the debt ceiling, on the economy, on the military budgets, the national debt, the interest on the debt. Pianchi was great about coming up with some figures. Gene was great about coming up with some figures. We've got all kinds of stuff we've been over. So we pretty much covered that. So let's welcome you
well,
here to get our report.
Have a nice day. I'll talk to you later.
Thank you, sir. Oh, there's more. We're not done. But just to know where we are, that we've covered a lot of that material already. In fact, I just found an article by Mark Thornton, who has been on the show, the Mises Institute, which is not too far from us up in Auburn University, Alabama. And so I'm going to see if I can get him on next week to talk about, he wrote an article in 2011, lowering the debt ceiling. So I've sent you that. I sent you another article. And so we can, you can peruse those at your leisure. But in the meantime, what's the official word on the economy?
All right. Well, we'll just talk about what's going on in the daily report, and we'll see where it goes from there. So this is Derek Park of Edward Jones bringing you the daily financial market report. Markets ended the day sharply higher as the S&P 500, Dow, and NASDAQ were up nearly 1%. Growth sectors outperformed value sectors as consumer discretionary, materials, and healthcare all outperformed. Of note that a deal was reached by Congress today to extend the debt ceiling through December 3rd, supporting risk assets and perhaps driving a bit of rally relief in the market. Jobless claims also came in slightly below expectations, underscoring on an ongoing recovery in U.S. unemployment. 10-year Treasury yield continues to grind higher as well, now at about 1.57%, up nearly 0.4 since August lows as the economy continues to recover. Stabilized Fed gets to start tapering assets purchases in November. Notably, the VIX, or volatility index, moved back down under level 20 levels, supporting further of today's positive market sentiment. U.S. equities closed higher, with the Dow Jones up 338 points, or 0.98, to 34,755. NASDAQ closed up 152 points, or 1.05%, to 14,654. And the S&P 500 was closed up 36 points, or 0.83, to 4,400. Again, in the bond market, Treasury yields, the 10-year Treasury yield is at 1.57. In the commodity markets, the price of crude oil was up $1.38, or 1.78%, to $78.81, and the spot price of gold was down $6, or 0.34, to $17.55.80. This is Derek Park of Ever Jones, member SIPC. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
Okay, so you lost me a little bit there because some of it was you know, That sort of financial language that they use, you know, and really kind of the Treasury. So when you talk about 1.57%, what is that figure exactly, and what is that what's that relate to?
So the 10-year, let's just talk about Treasuries for a second. So the Treasuries has a 13-week Treasury, 1-year Treasury, 2-year Treasury, 10-year Treasuries, 15-year, 20-year, 30-year. So on and so forth. Okay. Obviously, the shorter the duration, the lower the interest rate. The longer the duration, the higher the interest rate. Okay. The 10-year Treasury, why that one is the most specific, if you had to figure out where credit card interest rates and car interest rates and home interest rates are based off of, they're typically based off the 10-year. So if you see the 10-year going lower, you should see home loans ticking down, right? If you see the 10-year going up, you should see home loans ticking up, right? The 10-year Treasury is just what we use as the baseline for all where all interest rates come from. I don't want to say all, but let's just say most. And ideally, it's saying, you know, if you bought a 10-year Treasury, the current yield on it is 1.5%. So if you would have bought it what it was saying back in August, you know, it was down roughly 0.5%. You could have got it at about 1.2. So if you would have bought it at 1.2, technically it's worth more now. If you sold it, you'd make money.
Okay. I'm a little confused as I am because I, you know, deal with stuff all the time. It's kind of crazy, but the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, and then the Treasury has interest rates on their products. Can you kind of straighten this out on which is which you know, what happens when the Fed raises interest rates and what happens when the Treasury raises interest rates?
So the Treasury is raising interest rates because the Fed raises interest rates. So you have to understand one can't have one without the other. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not going to change in value because they are market sensitive. Why are they market sensitive? Well, it's based on our economy. It's based on how well they can sell the Treasuries. Okay, so, you know, obviously, what was going on back in August? Let's think about that for a second. You know, they were really worried about us defaulting on debt. You know, that's when that conversation really picked up, which means if we're going to default on debt, well, what does that mean? That means our bonds really aren't worth what they say they are. So everybody worries about value. So what happens to the value of our bonds? They go down, right?
Right.
Because we're going through I don't want to call it a crisis, but we can call it a crisis, right? We're going through an issue that may make our bonds seem unpalatable to people. You know, so obviously the value goes down. Well, now that you know, looks like they're trying to figure stuff out, we're seeing an increase. It's going back up, meaning that our bonds are worth more, right? So that's what you get with the market sentiment with our bonds, right? And then you have the Fed that says, you know, interest rates are going to go up half a basis point, right? Or half a percentage point. So if it goes up 0.5%, then what the Treasury can do is say, okay, we can now issue bonds at higher interest rates because the Fed has established a higher interest rate, which means more money is going to be coming in off of interest, right? So, and that's where, you know, they say bonds have interest rate risk, right? Meaning that if the interest rate goes down, and you bought one at a higher interest rate, or let me say a lower rate, a lower interest rate, and it goes lower, it's now technically worth less. You know, does that make sense? Like nobody's going to want that because the value has decreased. It means they're going to be issuing bonds that have less money. And then when the interest rates go up, it means they're going to be issuing bonds that have higher risk, or higher interest, which means they're more palatable. People are going to be like, okay, well, give me that bond. It's going to pay me more over time. Does that make sense?
It does. And then the question is, how is that interest paid? You know, so when they pay interest on these debt instruments, I guess they're called, that's Congress appropriating the money to pay that. That's the interest on the national debt. Is that how that works, or how is that connected?
If you're an individual bond buyer, then yes. You know, so I mean, you know, I've sold treasuries to people. You know, I mean, obviously, back when we had the nice COVID pullback, you know, if you had bought those treasuries beforehand, I mean, those 30-year treasuries were, what were they, about 2.5%? Just trying to guess. And like 30-year treasuries now are, you know, below 2, you know, or I think they're like 1.99. I'd have to go look at them again.
Well, who buys the 30-year treasury? Aren't those more like financial institutions and, you know, foundations, you know, long-term financial, the big investors? I mean, how many individuals hang on to a 30-year treasury?
I don't want to say a lot. You know, most of the people that I've had experience with are people that are actively trading them.
Okay.
They're looking for dips. They're looking for dips in the treasury market, or let's just say blood in the water, and they're buying an opportunity.
Yeah, buy low, sell high.
So, I mean, I've got some experience with a couple individuals that you know, when they saw the Fed was like, okay, we're going to aggressively start dropping interest rates, they bought up a bunch of treasuries at high yields. You know, I mean, they asked my thoughts on it, and I said, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, because once the value sinks on all the other treasuries, these things are going to be worth gold, you know, and that's exactly what happens. I mean, they essentially, on the treasuries that they bought, they have about a 24% return on.
Wow. That's amazing. And so they can't change the interest rates on these things. Or can they?
No, they can't. But what they can do, because they trade daily, is they can sell it to somebody that wants to buy it, because, you know, somebody wants that consistent, you know, 2.5 or 2.4, whatever. I'm just giving you a roundabout about what they are. Somebody wants that consistent high interest, because when, you know, how soon is the government going to be back at that rate where it even equalizes?
Yeah.
You know, hypothetically, it's probably going to be 3 to 4, maybe even 5 years from now.
Huh. So how about inflation, though? Because, you know, Bianca and I were talking about this a little earlier. In fact, Bianca, he's on the line. Feel free to jump in on this. But if you have inflation, you're losing, what, 5% of the value of your money? So if you've got a 2.5% yield treasury, you're still losing 2.5% overall.
Remember what they bought it at, Greg. Remember what they bought it at.
Okay, how does that work then?
So it does. So like I said, they bought it at a value, let's just say, of 2.5, making it easy, right? So if the interest rate sinks, you know, I mean, they have a percentage increase because the interest rate's lower. So they have a margin, a spread margin, basically. So if they wanted to sell that, obviously what the triggering mechanism to sell that is when the Fed comes back in and says, okay, we're going to start raising interest rates again. As soon as they say that, they're gonna offload these things. So they're making high interest. Yes, it's not keeping up, but they have a spread, you know, that these groups of individuals have bought. That if they sell them, which they'll sell immediately, I promise you they will. Somebody will buy them.
Okay.
You know, I mean, they're gonna make a profit on it because they're selling it at beyond par.
What's par? And then I'll get to Bianchi.
The par value is let's just say, if you put par at 100, it's actually at 1,000 for the bonds, right? Mm-hmm. But let's just say, well, you could say 1,000 just for easy numbers. If they bought the bond at par value, right, which was, let's just say they bought $10,000 worth, right? It was $10,000 they gave to buy that bond, a 2.5% bond at that time, right? Now, interest rates have sank, and a 30-year treasury yield is let's just say, you know, 2%. Okay. Well, you know, I mean, that's 50 basis points that thing has moved, and the government's now selling bonds at 2%. So their one that's at 2.5% is no longer par value. It's like 1,100 per first section, if that makes sense. So if you
okay,
wanted
no,
to
it
buy
does.
That, it's not going to, huh?
Makes sense.
But that, yeah. So if you're going to buy that bond from them, you would have to pay them $11,000, right? So that's 10%, if that makes sense.
So that's where your
right?
profit is. So the profit really,
that's
not just
where their
the
profit
interest.
Is.
The profit isn't actually
exactly.
selling the bond. Okay.
Yeah,
at the higher interest rate.
Partially. Plus their interest payments, right? So if
right.
you look at it, like if their spread, you know, is down mm-hmm. to, you know, at one point I actually had one person offload. They had bought, I want to say they're 2.5%. I'd have to go, they might be even 2.6. I'd have to go look, mm-hmm. you know, but, you know, their triggering mechanism was 1.15%. When the 30 year hit 1.15%, you know, I had a marker, I had to call them and I released all their bonds. And I mean, they made, I think it was like 31% return is what this individual got.
Wow. So we can do the
off
math based on, you know, yeah. That's huge.
Yeah, off of treasuries.
Wow.
I mean, that's you know, I mean, it was a timing thing. You know, I mean, it was somebody that's a lot more experienced in looking for these specific things.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if somebody wanted me to look for those specific things, I would. You know, I mean, it's an individual client. But, you know, what they're asking me to do is time interest rates. And you can do that. I mean, it's a strategy, you know, and it's a timing strategy. It's a crisis strategy. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, people kind of overlook bonds, you know, and I mean, they're just like, well, just throw it all in stocks, you know, because I can make a ton of money off the stocks. But, you know, debt actually has some good tools to make you some good returns.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I'll get to Bianca in just a second, but it's amazing that, you know, people go to work and they think that their hourly wage is the way to go and their savings account or whatever moderate investments they have. But the people that really make money, you know, they're not out there doing an hourly wage. They're not out there doing a salary. They're out there doing exactly what this person is doing. Is they're investing in treasuries, you know, the market. They've probably grown up in a family that has very sophisticated investment knowledge. You know, they probably have some money behind them. Then they're educated, you know, from day one, you know, about money.
Which not just that they have businesses as well.
You
know, I mean, there's books on this stuff, and it's called, you know, they call it the center of MSI, which the center of MSI is multi-sources
Derek,
of income, right?
You dropped off for a second. I don't know what happened, but we missed after you came back.
Can you hear me?
I can
now,
yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So it's called the center of MSI. Center of
What's
MSI
that?
Is multi-sources of income, right? So you need to have investment income. You need to have, like, rental income. You know, you need to have business income. You know, so these people have income from, you know, six or seven different places. And obviously that's really what creates millionaires.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, Pianki, I've been sort of holding you off a little bit. You have some questions for Derek?
Well, I was just going to tell him, presently, when you look at U.S. imported oil, it stands at about $218 billion. In 4 years, it would go up to $783 billion. That sounds like reverse progress to me.
Which figure is this? I'm confused now. Pianki, which one are you quoting?
That's on U.S. debt. U.S. debt clock is projecting that. It's pretty accurate.
In terms of
over
oil?
Over the years.
I'm not sure, Derek, you know.
All imports. Yeah, imported oil now is about we import about 218, U.S. imports about $218 billion a year in oil. In 4 years, we will be importing $783 billion in oil.
Okay. How much are we, ironically, I don't think we're importing hardly any under Trump when we were energy independent. Derek, do you happen to know what the figure was a few years ago?
We was independent under Trump. Now we're going to be, right now it's $218 billion that they're imported from other countries. And in 4 years, it's going to be $783 billion.
Are they assuming that we're not going to open up any energy here, that we're going to maintain the current policies or even make them more restrictive? What are they assuming when they come up with those figures?
Well, the way Biden is doing, we may not be producing anything, Hardy, the way it looks like.
Okay, let's talk about the oil market. Let's make it more general and talk to Derek about that. What's going on in the oil market?
Other than I've read some stuff that says, you know, there might be an impending natural gas crisis coming up because they're having shortages over in Europe. I haven't seen anything very specific, so I'd have to go look at what he's talking about.
Okay, oil stocks are not going crazy up and down or either way. There's nothing.
They've gone up in the past 6 months. They've gone up, not aggressively, but I would say that it's changed at least, let's just say 10 to 15% on average increase in the past 6 to 8 months.
Well, who buys our foreign oil? Do oil companies, the big ones, you know, Exxon, Texaco, Shell, Mobil, whatever these companies are. I mean, not Shell. They're Royal Dutch Shell. They're not based here. But who gets us our imported oil? Who actually pays for it?
I don't know. I'd have to go look.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I know that, you know, I actually know some personally oil execs that work in foreign countries, you know, that work for one of them works for Chevron and one of them works for Exxon. And they work in foreign countries because there's oil treaties or embargoes or whatever you want to call them, you know, that are going on. And I mean, their job is extremely specific to those countries, you know, to exporting oil out of those countries. How it works. I mean, actually, I'd probably, when I go play golf with the guy, I'll ask him.
Hey, let's get him on the show sometime. You know, we'll call the golf chat. You know, see if any of these folks that want to come on, they can come on anonymously. I've had one person, and I have a regular person on, does a medical freedom report, and they're all anonymous just because their jobs are at stake. You know, so anybody that wants to come on, they can come on and identify themselves or not. I'm more concerned with the information than the personality, but this is interesting. Maybe Gene, our crack researcher, producer extraordinaire, has made the show infinitely better. Gene, if you have a second to check that out, who buys our imported oil? How does it get here? I'd be curious. I think it would have to be the oil companies because they're the ones that take it and refine it. You know, we import crude oil, right?
It's bought by refineries.
Well, who owns the refineries? They're, quote, vertically integrated. You know,
well,
so the
many of them are privately owned.
Oh, they are?
I have my grandson, he in that business.
Okay, well, let's find out. Because if I understand it, like in California where I was, we had a Valero refinery. Valero is also a gas station. Now, there are rules. In fact, one of the problems with Standard Oil was they were what's called vertically integrated. So trusts. When you have antitrust action, it's not just control of the market, it's control of the industry. So vertically integrated means that the same company that drills for the oil, transports the oil, refines the oil, owns the gas stations, and has the petrochemical plants, has the fertilizer manufacturers, and the plastic, you know, they make the plastic companies, you know, all, in other words, they cover the entire industry and they call it barriers to entry so no one else can get in because they're so vertically integrated in that concept. Now, Derek, I don't know how much you know about antitrust stuff, but where does that stand now? Do the oil companies own the ships that bring our oil in? You know, how does foreign oil get here? And are they as vertically integrated as they were? Well, not to Standard Oil, because those companies have been broken up into, you know, Texaco, Chevron, Exxon, all those different companies, like seven of them, the seven sisters. But how integrated are the oil companies now, Derek, that you know?
So oil companies, I know that they own some of the ships. I also know that they don't own all of the ships. So what ratio that is, I don't know what ratio that is. So, like some of these super tankers are owned by independent companies. And I just used to have an acquaintance that was a merchant marine that used to work in that type of thing. You know, so I have a small understanding of it. What I would say is that how it's done, I don't really know. What I do know from recent times is that I have another friend that I went to high school with. I mean, I've known this guy for almost 30 years, I guess, or pretty close. He actually works in the testing field of petrol in the United States. And obviously, he is a contract guy that goes to, you know, Exxon, Chevron, all these gas stations and makes sure that they're hitting quality standards, if that makes sense. Actually, he gets them before they leave the refineries, right? You know, so he goes to the refineries and tests all their stuff and says, okay, is it meeting the industry standards, right? He basically said that they're gouging the market. You know, so he said that where prices are based on oil right now, he said you should see about a 25 cent difference in where it should be, what should be lower. He said that they're just basically trying to make up. They've stabilized the price and they're just going to kind of let it ride. That's why it's been at $3 for so long, is because they're playing catch up from last year.
when they lost so much because nobody could go anywhere. Yeah, you,
right.
You got to sell a
yeah,
certain
so,
amount. Yeah, okay.
So he said that he's not sure if you're going to see any change at that because he said some of this, you know, some of this oil crisis stuff that you hear is mm-hmm. is driven by fear that they put in the market even when it doesn't need to be there, if that makes sense. So they do that so they can
oh,
keep
listen,
the price up.
Fear. Fear is the number one commodity these days. Fear of COVID, fear of the debt ceiling, fear, you know, fear of we're all going to die from something. I mean, fear is the number one currency on display. Gene, I see you're active here. Did you want to jump into this?
Yeah, well, this article says in 2017, so it's a few years old, that Canada had the most oil exported from the U.S. But the weird thing is that then the U.S. also imports oil from Canada.
Okay,
yeah.
But I'm curious, like, how it gets here. And when I think of imports, I'm thinking not so much Canada because, of course, we give up the Keystone XL pipeline, which I'm sure will be back in 2024. You can tell what I'm hinting at here. But the big is the Middle East. And Venezuela used to be a major oil exporter. They were part of OPEC. But I'm thinking like the Saudi Arabias, the big, you know, United Arab Emirates, the folks that have Middle Eastern oil. How mm-hmm. who owns what to get it here? Do we buy it directly? And who buys it? The government doesn't buy it, you know, because they're not in the oil business yet.
It's oil companies.
Yeah,
it would be. When a tanker pulls up in port, it looks
right.
onto an oil line.
Right.
And then that oil line somewhere or another makes it to the national oil line. And that's where your refineries take their oil off of. You know, it's like an intersection of veins and capillaries that runs through the country. Remember, they just had an issue with natural gas here just this past winter. So that's how that works.
So the oil goes into a pipeline, so nobody knows whose oil it was. So they're selling it at the gas station level and the product level. Is that where it gets, you know?
Well, when the tankers pull in, they unload, and whoever receives it they pay the tankers. Of course, the tankers pay Saudi Arabia, wherever it comes from, Nigeria, and
okay.
That's how they work. It's a national supply. If you got a refinery and you need, say, 25 gallons, well, you tap off 25 gallons off the line and you pay for whoever owns those lines.
Okay. See, I assume that the tankers would have a pipeline to the local refinery. At least like the Chevron tankers I see, they used to watch coming into San Francisco Bay, would pipe directly into the Chevron refinery that was right there at the northern part of San Francisco Bay. And then it would go directly to the gas station and everywhere else. Right.
And
okay.
Believe it or not, some airlines have their own refineries also.
Airlines? Which airline has a refinery?
Well, at one time they were refining their own oil, own fuel, that is, when the prices were, you know, climbing excessively high. Airlines operate on a projected budget, and all of a sudden if something comes in and causes the price of fuel to go up, then that just blows their budget.
Well, and the fuel is a huge expense for airlines. Well, we haven't really asked Eric about airlines, so I don't know how, you know, you got a couple of minutes, and of course you're welcome to stay in the next hour simply because Jim's off this week. But airlines, you know, how are they doing in the market? What's the effect of fuel? What about their stupid mask regulations that are insane? What's going on with the airline markets that you know of?
I mean, I would tell you that right now, I mean, I think they're increasing, you know.
Increasing
so,
what?
Nobody's really worried. I mean, I just took a trip out of town here a week or so ago, and I mean, all the flights to the major cities were packed. I mean, they were full, you know. So I would tell you the airport, everybody was. I mean, now, so when you're on the plane, they're
right.
a little bit more draconian about keeping it on your face unless you're eating or drinking. And they do serve snacks and stuff, you know. But in the airport, I mean, there's some people walking with it down on their face. I mean, you know, it gets hot when you're huffing and you're trying to.
You have to wear it in the airport,
you know,
too?
Yeah. As soon as you hit the door, I mean, mass police are everywhere.
You know, what's so fascinating about that is that the virus, the COVID virus, in fact, any virus really, is 1,000 times smaller than a spaces in these masks. they're not designed for viruses. The paper ones aren't. You know, they talk about a mosquito going through a chain link fence, and I said that's not quite right. It's more like a mosquito going through a garage door. You know, these things are gaps. Now I'm talking about the basic blue China paper mask that everybody seems to be slapping on their face. You know, the ones with the parasites, the worms, the ones that create all these bacteria in front of your face and are basically a petri dish, as Judy Mikovits said yesterday, are designed to make you sick. And of course, if you get sick, then you want the vaccine. You know, so the masks are part of the marketing campaign. I don't think most people know that, and that's a whole different topic. I don't expect Derek to comment on that. But the thing is, the better masks, the N95s and some of those are stronger. But even those are only meant to be used for 3 or 4 hours and then tossed away, you know, for your typical operation. And so it's a very different. There are masks and there are masks. I mean, Dr. Judy Mikovits uses a silver mask, and she got assaulted on the airplane. Said, you can't wear that. That's not an approved mask. You know, wear this paper, useless one instead. And she's one of the top virologists, you know, in the world, and she knows exactly what mask to wear. And yet they're so ignorant that they're, again, fear is the currency that everybody's spending right now, and they're putting these stupid things. I just want to drive until this mask nonsense is over with. You know, and the sooner the better, as far as I'm concerned. I don't even want to take an airplane.
Well,
ride. I love flying.
I had the most basic. Let me tell you, this mask probably does next to nothing, the one that I had on my face, but,
is it cloth
nobody
mask
ever
okay?
said a word to me.
Wear a cloth mask? Can you wear a cloth mask?
Yeah, that's what it was. Nothing? I had a cloth one, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So that's the out.
I had
a
cloth one.
It's like a handkerchief. It doesn't do anything, but it virtue signals
right.
enough that you're complying with the dictates. It's hysterical,
right?
You know, yeah. Anyway, Pianki, go ahead. What do you think?
Yeah, I was going to ask you a comment. And this year, in 2021, the median price for a new home is about $368,000. They project in 4 years it's going to go up to $458,000. So how are people going to be able to afford a home when their income is only going to increase by $2,000? From 35 medium to 37 medium.
Yeah.
Well, that's the whole inflation question. You know, I mean, what happens? You know, I mean, the Fed is really up against some significant headwinds. So if the cost of goods, services, and supplies continue to rise, what'll happen is people will stop buying it. I mean, because they can't afford to buy it, and it will naturally drive the cost back down. Well, you have to understand the Fed has a little bit of control over that as well, and I've had that discussion. So the Fed, you know, can slow down printing money and selling bonds, which is, you know, what they're talking about, the tailoring of purchases and things like that. If as soon as they do that, that's going to put less money in the economy, which it should naturally bring inflation back a little bit. I personally believe, and everybody's starting to say this now, that beginning next year, they're going to start raising the rates. They're going to absolutely have to. I don't think they have to do it specifically in the first quarter. That's my anticipation is that they're going to do it. And the reason being is when they raise rates, it incentivizes people to put money back in the banks and stop spending it, right? Because now somebody's paying them to hold their money, right? So they need to do these at the same time, which is going to bring it all back down. What is that going to imply? The housing market should take a little bit of a hit. It should. You know, so they can predict that it's going to be at 450,000. That doesn't mean that it's going to be there right now. Obviously, housing prices right now are through the roof. It's a seller's market. If you want to sell your house, it's a good time to sell your house, but it's also a terrible time to buy, you know, because you're buying at those same high prices that you're selling at, you know, so that's why the rental market's hot right now.
Yeah, that's the problem too, supply and demand. If the housing supply is low, then rentals go up and makes rentals more expensive, and people rent generally because they can't afford to buy a house. So you're gradually increasing the proportion of people that are renting. Here's something else too. These big corporations are buying huge amounts of houses at above market rates. Either they're turning them into rental property or they're controlling them. Has that had a real impact on the market that you know of? Anybody talking about that?
I'll even talk about it in this area. I mean, there's a company out of California that owns something like, I don't know, 600 rentals in this area.
What?
You know, which, yeah, that's...
You can mention the name.
I
don't care. You can mention the name.
I don't
want.
Know the name. I'd have to ask.
Mention it next week.
I'd have to ask. But they bought up three properties in a community that I know. And I wouldn't have known this, but I was involved trying to help this individual with their homeowners association because of what happened with mine. You know, so I was trying to help
Karen
them. And they
tell
were like,
you?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it has nothing to do with that. They were trying to get out from underneath the property management company because they're kind of extorting the homeowners association. And yeah, they were doing the same thing to us. So I was trying to help this individual, you know, I was linking them up with our people and, you know, they were, I was telling them what to do. And I, you know, I went to one of their meetings and they were like, oh, well, these three houses are rentals and they were owned by the same company. And I was like, well, dang, that's weird. We have two in our thing. So we got a guy that's like a, this guy needs to be a lawyer. He's not a lawyer that's in my housing development. And, you know, the guy's like, oh yeah. He's like, here's what's going on with that company. He had all the background, the information. I was like,
well, let's get
him
on the show too. And I want everybody, you know, all these cool people. I want to know what they know. So I think that's, you know, let's bring them on. I want your oil executives. I want anybody else. Let's talk about real estate, but this is fascinating. And of course we haven't even talked about China and foreign investors buying property. Yeah. And then taking the money out of the country, but this whole idea
that's been going on for years, man.
Yeah. So the question then is where does the local government have control? You know, can the county supervisors, for example, block this California company from even buying here, or is it a free market? They don't have a choice. You know, can we control our own county?
If you don't have a homeowners association, so that's what I learned. If your homeowners association has it written into the bylaws that says there can't be, you know, a rental monopoly going on in your property, you know, then that's the only thing that can stop it. But if you don't have a homeowners association, good luck. I mean, it's free market; they can do what they want to do.
Yeah, and the problem with the homeowners association, like I said, is run by Karens, and they're some of the most obnoxious, power hungry, obsessed people. You know, they even make jokes about it in the commercials. You know, your mailbox is too high. You remember that one where the lady cuts down the mailbox and all this kind of stuff? Because these are the people
the
that don't
around
want you to,
here aren't that bad.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah,
we're still okay. Florida. Yeah. Yeah, for now.
Yeah.
So the Karens, you know, want to take down the American flag and all that kind of stuff. But we'll keep them out of here, too. Stay in California. Thank you. Pianchi, go ahead.
This year, you got 43 million food stamp recipients. Four more years, it's going to go up to 57 to 58 million. I don't know why. What are you going to do with these refugees? You know, I'm going to tell you guys something. If I was a business, which I was, and looking at these numbers, I couldn't sleep at night.
Well, that's a good question. That's another thing for us to talk about. Derek, I appreciate you staying a little bit longer today. What about the impact of these illegal aliens? They're not refugees. Refugees go to the next available country to escape a cataclysmic situation where their life is in danger or they're being politically persecuted and about to be thrown into a gulag. These people are here for money. They're not here because they're refugees. They're not seeking refuge. They're seeking money. So let's call them what they are, parasites. Illegal aliens. But the impact on the economy, has the market even begun to explore what's going to happen with all these people working illegally and sending money out of the country and costing us, you know, infrastructure? You know, we got the roads are going to be filled up with more people. The schools are going to be filled up with more illegal alien kids. They still have that illegal birthright citizenship policy where all these folks who are having babies, you know, the hospitals are immediately giving them U.S. citizenship and Social Security cards, none of which is legal by the 14th Amendment. And I've explained that tons of times. Is the market even saying anything about this, or do they think of these as just new consumers?
Not yet. You know,
okay.
I mean,
they're idiots.
You know, I guess looking at it just like you said it, they look at it as new consumers. But, you know, I mean, obviously the economy, I don't want to say the economy is going to deal with it. You know, the government's going to deal with it because that's just more people that are going to end up on social systems and get, you know, get more free handouts, you know. So then I think really that's what the ultimate goal is. You know, I mean, a lot of people don't see it as, you know, as the government impending more control.
Yeah, yeah. Let me pull up a Facebook thing I wrote last night on what I call the Great Replacement. You know, let me see if I can pull this up real quickly. Where did I put it here? So the Great Replacement, if I can summarize it, I can't find exactly where I wrote it. I got too many Facebook posts right now. But for Americans, the Great Replacement is Americans are systematically being, you know, destroyed, lowered in population, and lives made worse by, you know, everything from abortion to, you know, the taxes being raised to the cost of living so you can't have as many kids, so you can't buy a house now because they're becoming more expensive, to the median income is being gradually lowered. There's all that, you know, to forced vaccinations, forced masks, forced mandates, lockdowns, removal of jobs, you know, elimination of you know, businesses, mom-and-pop shops, you know, which creates addictions, you know, dependencies, all kinds of other things going on. So what Americans are facing is a truly horrible situation by our own government. Now, for illegal aliens, well, they get free health care, they get money, they get to travel anywhere they want in the country, they don't have to take the vaccine, they can spread any disease they want, they have unlimited benefits, they're going to get free college, free everything, and they're probably going to end up with a pathway to citizenship. So you look at the you know, all the we're treating illegal aliens like citizens, and we're treating citizens like illegal aliens, where the problem really becomes the American citizen, the independent, rugged, individualist American is the greatest threat to the Marxist cabal that has basically stolen our government. Now, you don't have to comment on that part of it, but the situation is we're being replaced. We Americans are being replaced by a compliant peasant population of folks that, because of the welfare, can have all the kids they want, because of the Supreme Court decision, can be in our schools, and people are willing to hire them at low wages to get the jobs they want. And most of that money is going to end up going back to their home countries and families anyway. Is anybody looking at that?
Yeah,
I want to get Derek first, then I'll go to you. All right, go ahead, Derek.
Yeah, and it's being talked about, but it's being talked about not in a large setting. You know what I mean? It's being talked about by the people that see it happening rather than the people that can stop it from happening. You know, so I mean it's going on. Everybody knows. Are we having an impact in the market? No. You know, will we have an impact in the market? I would say if you're bringing more people into buying more goods and services, the impact of the market would be positive. You know, what does it do to our government? Well, I mean, I guess they look at it like more financing debt. I mean, it comes more from the middle class. I mean, the more that they can tax you, you know, the more that they have money to spend on things we don't need.
Yeah, and one of the biggest problems is it's illegal for illegal aliens to pay taxes, and yet they do under the ITIN number, the individual tax identification number, which is a little trick the IRS pulled off so they could collect money from illegals, you know, while they're here. So in other words, these people can't be here, but we're going to take their money anyway, which allows them to think they can buy their way into being here because they're paying taxes, neither of which is legal. Pianchi, you had a comment.
Well, that don't make sense because for every illegal that's here working, some legal person's not working. But what I want to know is this. With your total federal income revenue is $3.8 trillion, your debt is $29 trillion. And your GDP, U.S. federal debt to GDP, is about 26% more than 100%. How is this all going to work?
Oh, that's a great question.
It sounds bad, but look at it like this. And this is actually a good analogy. You know, so obviously you just said, you know, the median house price in the USA is $300,000. Well, what's the average income? The average income is like $50,000 or $55,000, right? So
that's family
the
income.
The median income is $35,000.
Individuals, yeah, $35,000. So you're looking at 70 maybe combined income for family income with two parents.
Right. Okay. So let's just say $35,000, and the median price is $300,000. That's fine. You know, so use those numbers. The bottom line is, if you stopped everything you were doing and didn't pay anything else except your house note, you would have your house paid off in 10 years, right? Okay, by those numbers. Okay,
right.
So the national debt is no different. You know, if we're bringing in $3 trillion, and the national debt is $30 trillion, if we stopped everything we're doing, we'd have it paid off in 10 years. Well, it doesn't work that way in the government. You know, obviously we have to spend money, we have to stabilize. So that's why we finance things for 30 years, right? So technically, what happens in 30 years is where your argument comes in, and it's not an argument. I mean, our debate or what we're talking. You know, is the fact that they keep spending more and more and more, so it keeps raising it. You know, obviously, every household in the U.S. ideally is to get yourself out of debt, right? And the government doesn't want to do that. The government wants to say, okay, let's just keep raising it. So right now, theoretically, if they finance the debt that they have and we stabilize, we would have it paid off in, let's just say, 30 or 40 years, which is feasible, right? It's not feasible because we keep adding more spending and raising the debt.
Yeah, it's a willpower issue. It's not a technological issue. Well, this is why I published my constitutional budget. So just to put the numbers in fairly simple context, you can fund everything that's constitutional in the federal budget, Article 1, Section 8, for about $1 trillion, maybe $1.3 trillion, $1.4 trillion, whatever, it doesn't matter. But just for the sake of simple numbers, around $1 trillion. If the federal revenue is about 3.9, let's say $4 trillion, you're looking at a $3 trillion surplus per year above, you know, what the government is legally allowed to spend under the Constitution. You know, I even proposed, Derek, I know you may not have heard this on the show earlier, but I proposed actually taking the federal budget to the Supreme Court and getting a ruling that it exceeds Article 1, Section 8. Therefore, the federal budget itself is unconstitutional. We're going to talk more about that as time goes by. But the point is that I prove very simply by going through the actual departments that are result from the clauses in Article 1, Section 8, that the federal budget is about $1 trillion. And I sent that to Dr. Walter Williams. You know, when he was still around, he's since passed on, which is really too bad. He was one of my first big interviews, and we talked about this. And he said he was the one that kind of put me on to the basic parameters. And he says, yeah, about $1 trillion is constitutional. So I actually measured it by looking into these departments, and I found that yeah, about $1 trillion. I think it's like $1.4 trillion. But that when I did this, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, the government had more revenue, so it was actually making about $4.5 trillion. So $1.5 trillion expenditure to $4.5 trillion. Revenue is a $3 trillion surplus. If that $3 trillion, and that's talking about the legal expenditure, so we're not cutting anything that that is constitutional out of the federal budget, they can pay it off in 10 years with a $30 trillion, probably less than that, because you know every time you pay off the national, the interest on the national debt goes down too. So it's a cumulative, you know, effect, compounding, I guess, you know, that you guys call it in the economic stuff. So it can be done. Okay, now, how would that have to happen? Here's where it gets sticky. You'd have to privatize Social Security. You'd have to privatize Medicare. You'd have or bring them to the states, and you'd have to eliminate the entitlements. And so that's the part where the problem is, but this is how you do it. I've proven that it is legal to get rid of the national debt in 10 years by simply passing a constitutional budget. And then, of course, my new ideas that I got from Ron Paul is that we have a constitutional amendment removing the power of Congress to borrow money. And I think that would be a huge thing.
Yeah, no, man, that'd be amazing. It would. Hey, Greg, I gotta step out. I gotta get things started. So not to cut you short, but
I
agree with everything you just said, man. I mean, I think that would be a good idea.
Okay. If you haven't gotten those already.
I was just getting ready to come up with some harder questions than you run.
Okay. Yeah. Well, he's got to go. He's longer than he usually stays.
Yeah.
All right, Derek, thank you so much.
You
if you get a chance
care.
To if you get a chance to review the constitutional budget video I sent or the article, and I'd be really curious your thoughts. Thank you. We'll do it next week. Goodbye now. Yeah, that's Derek Park of Edward Jones Financial Advisors here in Pace, Florida. So you can, if you missed, you know, all his information, he gives it at the beginning of his report, and you can catch on to it there. Pianki, hold on for just a second. I want to play something. We have a little spot here from our new webmaster, and I want to play this, and back to you. And you can ask me those hard questions, and I won't be as Derek, but I'll try my best here and see what I can come up with. So we'll be right back. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with a personal recommendation and testimonial for Eric Colley, our new webmaster and marketing guru. Eric has been invaluable in upgrading our website, writeyourlaws.com. To help you with your marketing, Eric Colley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. Most business owners don't have the time or expertise to excel at marketing. Even fewer have the funds to hire a special employee. And you don't have to. There is a better option. Eric Colley, a consultant who uses leading-edge marketing strategies to increase your profitability at costs which are far more affordable than an advertising or marketing agency. You can be seen high up in Google's Page One. You can dominate Google's local three-pack of businesses next to the search results map. You can be trusted as much as personal recommendations from family and friends. You can increase foot and website traffic. You can do all this, all without paying Google, Facebook, or Instagram, One Red Cent. Eric Colley can be reached at 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. His website is besmallbusiness.com. That's besmallbusiness.com. BESMALLBUSINESS. besmallbusiness.com. And you can reach him by email at eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's how you do it. Action Radio. Part of the ADHD Radio Network. The ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed, and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio. That helps to unmute my mic. People can actually hear me when I do that. Okay, there we go. I'm back on the air. I love that promo. It's just such a kick doing that. But, yeah, it's true. You know, and so we are doing things that no one else has even thought of, which is quite fascinating. Okay, Pianki, we got about 10 minutes before Chappie gets here with the gun tech report, and I got to make him a theme. So, yeah, fire your best questions. If you want to save them for Derek for next week, I mean, feel free. Normally this is the time when Jim Dykes is on during the Second Amendment report. And so it's interesting. We had the three guys that do the reports on Fridays, Derek Park, Jim Dykes, and Donnie Chapman, are all veterans. So it's kind of like Veterans Day, you know, here at Action Radio, which I'm really kind of proud of. So this is fascinating how this all works. All right, Pianki, you have my undivided attention.
Well,
Gene, if you have a question too, go ahead, Pianki.
The interest on the U.S. debt is $406 billion.
Okay.
Why do we use the Federal Reserve? Isn't the U.S. Treasury capable of performing those duties? Then you wouldn't have a $400 billion interest.
Well, there's only one problem. The Federal Reserve is neither federal nor a reserve. It's a private bank consortium of folks that basically run our economy for themselves. So the Federal Reserve and the Federal Reserve notes, that has nothing to do with, you know, the Treasury actually has funds. I mean, the Treasury, you know, that's the Treasury. That's where they keep the money, you know, Fort Knox and all that kind of stuff. But as for actually, you know, having money that the Federal Reserve can put into the economy, no. They regulate it for themselves. They set interest rates. They control the money. They don't have the money. Does that make sense?
Well, no, it doesn't make sense because the U.S. Treasury could do all of that.
Well, yeah, there's no reason for a federal. Yeah, there's no reason for Federal Reserve. Well, you can't eliminate interest because you're not going to get people to buy the Treasury securities to allow the money to be borrowed.
The U.S. Treasury can charge interest. They pay interest on bonds, don't they?
Yeah, but I don't think they set the interest rate.
You don't need a Federal Reserve.
We don't need a Federal Reserve.
You don't need a Federal Reserve.
All right, I'll see what I'm going to do. I'm going to write down right now Federal Reserve, because I'm not exactly clear, so I'm not going to try and, you know, think.
Yeah,
of, I mean, I'm trying
I'm
to
telling
yeah,
you.
So Federal Reserve. So let's get the difference in duties. I'll do some research on that. Federal Reserve versus the Treasury. Where does the distinction lie?
Because what the Federal Reserve do is instruct the Treasury to print up money that it is selling the Treasury bonds on. If you build an aircraft carrier, it costs you $50,000. Well, mm-hmm. the Federal Reserve would print up a bond for $50,000, sell it to the U.S. Treasury. They print $50,000, plus they pay interest to the Federal Reserve, which is private banks. It's a big racket.
I know it's a big racket, and like I say, I'm going to get that clear, because usually the defense budget comes from an appropriation. And that appropriation then, you know, if they have the money, well, they don't have to borrow any money. They just spend it, and the Treasury would then, you know, pay the bill. But that's a really good question. Let me Okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to bring Chappie on here a little bit earlier. Donnie Chappie Chapman, who is Gun Tech. I asked him if he wanted to drop in a few minutes early because Jim can't make it. But we want to talk about economics just for a couple minutes longer. Chappie, you want to get in on our economic discussion? Do you have any opinions on that?
I've had a chance to listen just came in, so I'll sit back and listen and pipe in when I hear something good.
Okay, I want to talk about you. So let me take one more question, Pianchi, and then I want to get to Chappie, and I miss Friday playing with guns. So if we can't play with guns on Friday for at least an hour, I feel like I've missed something. So go ahead. And you have another question, Pianchi? Yes, no, maybe. Pianchi? Going once, going twice?
No, I have no more question. I was going to tell Chappie that they had a gun show in Missouri, right in St. Charles County. And ooh, people are lined up around the block to get into it.
Let's get into our gun tech report. And Chappie, I'm going to make a theme for you. I just haven't quite decided how exactly I want to do it. I want to sort of get a feel for what we talk about here over a few weeks. Then I'll be able to do something accurate. But gun shows, we haven't talked about that yet. What's going on with them? What's happening with sales? And especially in a place like Florida, where we actually have, you know, real guns you can sell, as opposed to California, where you have wimpy little, baby guns approved by the state. What's going on?
Well, I think it's the easiest way for people to find ammo. Unfortunately, the people running the gun shows are kind of raising the prices. They're just through the roof.
Are they exploiting us gun owners, us little Second Amendment people who just want to, defend ourselves and compete and buy really cool guns? I heard absolutely. Yeah, go ahead. Let's get the truth. You can be brave. Go for it. What's going on?
Yeah, people are raising the price because they know people are kind of in dire straits right now for ammunition. And then, of course, you have all the new people that bought firearms, so they're going to want to test their new firearm out, so they're going to need ammo. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. they're kind of pressed up against the wall, so they're going to pay for it. And then you have, the average person that just wants to go out and shoot that owns guns, and again, they're going to pay for it. So, and then the other aspect is, let's say you do want a certain model firearm, and the regular gun stores can't get it, or if you try to go online, you can't find it. So they're going to go to the local gun show and hopefully try to barter the price down a little bit, but the prices are still pretty high at the gun shows as well. So,
but people at a gun show, those are just like gun stores. They just pack their guns up and they bring them to the gun show. With all the other gun stores.
Yeah, some of them. Yeah, but almost it's weird. Sometimes at the gun show, it almost seems like it's like a garage sale. Or I call gun shows sometimes the gun flea market, because it's, you have everything there. You have a person selling firearms to the person making cotton candy. It's kind of a mix of everything. So.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I used to enjoy gun shows. But then I suddenly, after a while, I realized I'd seen it all before. As a new gun owner, you could gun shows. This is great. I got to go, to this bazaar, like the Mogadishu, arms bazaar.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Especially
stuff
in our area.
Yeah.
It just rotates from Tallahassee, then our area, then it goes to Alabama, and then it just does the full circle, and it's the same group all the time. So it's not like you're really going to see anything new here.
That's
in
what
area.
I found.
So,
yeah. Well, let's talk about St. Louis then. Jackie, what's going on?
Actually,
St. Louis is a Republican state or area, or is it more Democrat? Mm-hmm. Missouri's Republican, but St. Louis is Democrat.
Yeah.
So, Pianchi, what's going on there? Why was the line around the block for this?
Well, the gun shows are usually held in St. Charles County, which is a Republican county.
Okay.
Yeah.
But my daughter went, and she said there's a lot of black American women buying guns. A lot of them.
Ooh, what a great market segment. I got a funny story about that in just a little bit. Chappie, did they break it down that much?
Actually,
is there any, what's going on?
Oh, yeah, actually, I used to be stationed at Scott Air Force Base and used to go to the gun shows in St. Louis. And I know where St. Charles is, that great area. St. Louis actually has – that area actually has really good gun shows. So to see it – and they're pretty huge. So to see it, the line wrapped around the building, that's a lot of people in that place. So.
Wow.
But
so why are black women buying
more,
guns? We'll get to that in a minute. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, to protect themselves. You know, I think not just black females, but everybody's starting to see that, hey, you can't spend or depend on the law enforcement to get there in a timely manner, especially when a lot of counties in the nation are, you know, defunding the police. So they want to protect themselves. I think they're starting to see there's a rise in crime, lack of protection. So it's time to, you know, use our Second Amendment right and protect ourselves.
Yeah, it's interesting. The story
and
I want to get to.
That.
Go ahead, Bianca, and then I'll get to my story. Yeah, go ahead.
Not only that, they can't run no place now. You know, they run from crime-ridden areas in urban areas, go out into the suburbs, but the crime follows them right out in the suburbs with the cost of housing, the cost of rental, and then with these notions like you may mention, defund and dissolve police forces, it leaves people with no other option. You got to defend yourself.
Yep.
Yeah, it's interesting. What I was going to say was years ago I worked in a gun store in Oakland. And so you had an awful lot of black customers because a lot of Oakland is black area, folks living there. And so what I found fascinating was I actually had a lot of black women customers because it wasn't one of those good old boys, you know, here, little lady, this is the gun for you, which is one of the problems of the gun industry. I don't know how much it still is, but it was. We're talking like 30 years ago. Anyway, what was fascinating was that a lot of the women who came to me had just lost their husbands. And so there was a real need, whereas the husbands either had a gun or protected them or didn't have a gun for whatever reason, they didn't get a gun until their husbands had passed on. And they were scared. And there was like, you know, because crime was a problem. Now they're on their own. And now they have to defend themselves. And it comes to a gun. So we actually talked about, I had instructors, you know, that we were calling. And we actually got those folks. Because these are people that didn't grow up with guns. It hasn't been a part of their life. But it just happened that I had a lot of black women customers who were recent widows who bought guns. And this is back years and years ago. And so it became kind of you know, where I could help folks, where I could direct them. And one of the biggest things was lessons and then to use it because people didn't have that familiarity. And that's something I wish that all the gun companies would be to offer a lesson with the purchase of a gun or some kind of something to get people trained. We can talk about that too. But now there's all kinds of folks who can't escape their living situation, who can't buy a house, who, you know, the rental prices are going up and the crime is going up because you got places like Oregon, you know, where riots are no problem. You know, you got George Soros attorney generals that aren't prosecuting crime. So crime is going up because nobody's held accountable. And people also, you know, and I would say the whole idea of black women would traditionally have been a Democrat constituency, you know, who would probably been opposed to guns and probably voted for, you know, pro-gun control candidates now finding themselves on the other side of the issue saying, well, wait a minute, yeah, I think I need to get one, so I can't vote for those pro-gun people anymore, and I want to be able to have the ability to purchase those guns. So there's some very interesting issues going on here. Yeah, Pianchi?
And see, here's the thing, too, Chappie. When we talk about the east of the Missouri River, you're talking about heavily Democrat.
Yeah.
Now, blacks are moving across the Missouri River into Republican areas that's majority white police department. So that old issue is only certain voices that's talking about defund and dissolve police department because the average person don't want that. And apparently blacks really don't feel the way people project them to feel about policing when you got them moving into white counties that have majority white police officers and majority white population. What's going on there?
I got a comment. Sheppy, why don't you go first, though?
I think people are just starting to wake up and see how corrupt the Democrats are. And like, for instance, again, like I said, I was stationed down there. Yeah, it was night and day on the Illinois side compared to the Missouri side. It was night and day with the laws and everything, even with care. You know, a lot of doctors were jumping ship and going over to the Missouri side just for a lot of those reasons as well. So
interesting. Yeah, Chad, we're going to get to your topics here. But what I think is fascinating that I think is happening here that nobody's really picked up on yet is that people think the greatest divide people think of this country is racial. It's really not. It's personality, it's culture, it's living situation. So if you have black citizens moving to what are, you know, predominantly white areas, suburban areas. You've got a lot, you know, black suburban residents and white suburban residents have a lot more in common than black and white suburban residents have in common with city residents, you know, especially inner city, you know, poor areas in the city. And so what you have is the people that want to move out to the suburbs don't want that inner city. They don't want that life. They want something better for themselves, and the suburbs is what they think of it as. So I bet you if you took, you know, random black suburban, you know, middle-class families and white suburban middle-class families, there wouldn't be a divide. They're pretty much in the same situation. You know, and so there's this idea that things are changing, but I don't think people are noticing that change. Bianchi?
Well, see, here's the thing. And the politics is what causes it. Okay. And I'm not talking evil. I wish everybody well. But when you have blacks that's paying $468,000 for a medium house, they right. want the value to go up, not go down.
Right.
But when you insert certain category, socioeconomic populations next to them are inserted mm-hmm. within them, then okay. things begin to happen. And they don't like that. I don't blame them. Nobody wants to pay $468,000 for a home, and 15 years later, the value is down to about $275,000. That make sense.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. But like I said, my contention is I'm curious more about the gun market. You know, I'd just be curious if different racial breakdowns in this country are buying different guns. We'll talk about that another time. Chappie, let's get on to your topics here. We've got about 25 minutes left, so I don't think you get carried. We do get carried away here. It's really kind of fascinating. So what's going on in gun tech? What's going on in competitions? What's going on in what you want to talk about?
Well, yeah, so last weekend me and some others from Team Chappie Tactical, we went down to New Smyrna and shot the Area 6 Steel Challenge match. It's a level 3 match. And our top shooter, Gatlin Johnson, scored first, second, third, and fourth. He shot in four different divisions. So
what? Wait a minute. What? I know you mentioned before, like, but who is this guy? How does he do all these different competitions? Is he a professional competitor, or is he just really good? I mean, how does someone get good at this stuff?
He is a grandmaster, so it's the highest level you can reach. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he's sponsored by Chappie Tactical and a few others, so that helps pay for, you know, some of his ammo, and well, I help pay.
How much does he go through?
Ammo.
How much does he go through a week in practice? I'm just curious. 1,000 rounds, 5,000 rounds, what?
Well, he does a lot of dry fire, so a few hundred rounds. I know he's practicing a day, so he's probably going through a couple hundred rounds of 22 right now. So,
just a warm up.
A lot of dry fire, just a warm up. Yeah, basically, and what he does also before a day before a match, he hits the range and he function checks all his firearms, make sure that after they're cleaned and reassembled, that you know, all the magazines are running well, his firearms running well. So, so that's how he does it. And so, he scored first, second, third, and fourth. We're all really proud of him. He's a super humble guy, and he really put he turned it on last weekend, and he really impressed everybody.
Well,
so
let's get
him
on the show.
Proud of him.
It sounds like someone I would want to talk to. Yeah, this would be great.
Absolutely.
Here's the thing too. So in a more general question is, for me, the value of competition is not whether how good I am against other shooters. The value of me for competition is that it made me a better shooter, because I think a lot of people will buy a gun and that's it. You know, okay, I've got a gun, I'm done.
Yeah.
And you're not done. But just what you said, he function checks his firearm. How many private owners of guns buy a gun, put it in a closet, and just leave it there for a rainy day? And when they go to use it, you know, it's rusted, you know, the ammo's old, something's wrong with it. And your life, I think of my guns as my life. If my life is really on the line and I need that gun, it better damn well work. Now, the engineers have produced a good gun or it wouldn't be on the market. There's all kinds of consumer product safety things we'll talk about sometime too. But they spend a lot of time making sure these things work, because they have to work every time. And so, but you still have to check them. You still have to be proficient. You have to handle the gun. You have to, you got to take care of it. You got to maintain it, but you don't, you know, over maintain it. You know, there's only so much clean that's needed. Do what's needed and don't soak it in oil. It's not going to work. I had to take apart a Ruger GP100 that I got a little enthusiastic with the WD-40. What's the brand? freak freak. If you want to say the wrong thing, so forget that.
CLP.
That out.
CLP.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, but I had a little too much, and I thought, you know, if some is good, you know, more might be better. I want to make sure all those parts are lubricated. And it actually, as the gun heated up, it gummed it up. And so I got a YouTube video, took it all apart, which is fascinating too. And that works great. I just, you know, one or two drops, you know, in the mechanism, and that's it. It's all it needs, right? So, but these things you don't know unless you get in competition, because you don't heat up your gun. You don't, you know, put it through its paces, and you don't test yourself. So the value, and I want to return to this theme a lot, but the value of competition is that you are really training you, and you're seeing what your gun can do and what they cannot do, and you're seeing what you can do and cannot do. And it puts a reasonable, you know, if you're ever in a life-saving situation, especially if you do IDP, International Defensive Pistol, which is one of my favorite competitions, you know, you're in scenarios and you go, oh, wait a minute, things that you never expected would be a complication as you're visualizing, you know, you're a superhero, you're bulletproof and your shots are always going to be accurate. And all of a sudden you find under stress, well, gee, I shot better at the paper, you know, last week. Well, of course, the paper wasn't moving. You weren't under stress. There wasn't something
you're
with a timer.
You're standing up, shooting
you know,
down the lane.
You're shooting down lane. Everybody's like nice and genteel. You know, it's a totally different environment. So, you know, I think I've covered it, but just to make sure, you know, value of competition. What do you think?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing competition does for the average shooter, it induces stress. Because once you hear that timer, all your plans of everything go out the window. But the more you practice it and the more repetitions you do, it just becomes natural so that maybe when you're in that real-world situation at the grocery store or where be – it's going to come natural. You're going to draw your pistol and defend yourself and defend others around you. And plus, you're also learning safety, though. You're learning to move with your finger off the trigger, making sure your firearm's pointed in a safe direction. And then, again, it's you're practicing those situations in competition that you're not normally going to do at a regular range where it's indoor, air-conditioned, the light's perfect, and everything else. Mm-hmm. So that's what, you know, that's the best part about competition. Again, you're also shooting, you know, at angles. You're not just standing up shooting. Sometimes you're going to have to bend down. And then, like you mentioned, IDPA, you know, there is sometimes, you know, they're kind of scenario based. So, we've had a match before where you're in a position and there's like we've had a car out there before and you're changing a tire and the situation is, and try attacking you. So on the buzzer, you drop the tire iron and you start shooting, you know, to your attackers. So that's just one type of situation you may be in real life that you're not going to get at the normal indoor range, that experience.
Are you using the car for cover in that situation?
It depends on the stage plan, but sometimes the other stage plan will say you're using the car as cover. We've had rifle events where we've had the use the car as cover because you're supposed to like when brace yourself on the car or you had to shoot behind the car. So, yeah.
Wow. This is fascinating. Hey, Fianchi, have you ever competed? I'm dragging back in the conversation.
Pardon me?
Here. Oh. Have you
what
ever
you
competed,
say?
Fianchi?
No, not in that. Only when I was a kid, I used to shoot the neighbor's clothespin with their laundry hanging in their yard. They come home, all their laundry on the ground. I used to do it with my BB gun.
The things we learn on this show, Bianchi, you're getting more complex all the time. You're bad. You're a bad kid. I'm not encouraging that, by the way, folks. So this is, you know, that's not an officially Action Radio approved activity. Don't shoot your neighbor's clothespins. Anyway, Chappy?
Another scenario, we had our first match, you know, once COVID kicked off and that, you know, we finally opened back up in Florida. One of the scenarios in IDPA, we had a grocery bag of toilet paper and we had like a checkout lane that you're at the grocery store buying toilet paper and a mob came in and on the buzzer, you dropped the toilet paper. Or actually on the buzzer, you had to hold the bag of toilet paper and shoot one-handed through the scenario. So.
Oh, that's a great scenario. Yeah, because toilet paper is precious these days. Well, not so much now, but during the show. Mm-hmm. No, but that's fascinating. Actually, you can use that as a distraction. You know, I don't know if they ever do this in IDPA, but, you know, what I thought of, you know, if I ever needed, you know, just that extra second to draw, I might, like, throw my keys out just as a distraction in the face of somebody. You know, just, I mean, do you ever, it'd be interesting, has that ever been used, other objects that you just happen to have in your pocket, you know, before you can draw your gun? Just, like, throw, I often wonder if that would be a realistic you know, thing to do in an actual emergency, just toss some keys in their face while you're drawing. There, boom.
I've seen people sometimes, like, on their keys, they'll have their flashlight, so they'll blast the person in the eyes first to kind of distract them, then draw their firearm. So, yeah, I mean, that's one scenario that you can do.
Yeah. Okay.
I got a scenario.
Okay.
Yep.
I'm still back at the clothespins, but anyway, go ahead.
If you got a perpetrator that has attacked you, and they have a gun, and they are running from you, but raise their arm up toward the back and shoot at you, can you shoot them in the back?
Chappie?
Well,
Peggy's laughing. I hear him laughing. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, now they're evading, but if they're still shooting at you, so your life is still threatened, at that point, I'd shoot at him. I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6 at that point. So, yeah, I would shoot back.
Well, actually, that's a fascinating scenario. I'll tell you, the lawyers for the defense would say they were running away from you. They weren't even looking. And your lawyer would say, well, wait a minute. You know, one of those shots could just as easily kill you, whether it's aimed or not.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a couple of different ways to look at it. That's actually an interesting scenario. You know, that's more the legal stuff. Mm-hmm. Guns that people are using, and we always get back to that, what are some of the more popular firearms that people are using for competition? Just regular ones.
Starter gun. The big one that everybody, I think, kind of starts out with is the Glock 34.
Which is what?
Kind of, it's a 9mm Glock. It's a little bit longer slide than the Glock 17, which is what a lot of people have, most average Glock, which is the Glock 17, Glock 19. So the Glock 34... And especially now that they have the Glock 34 Generation 5 MOS, so now it has a plate that you can put on there and put a red dot on there, which is pretty popular right now. So the Glock 34 is pretty popular. Moving up a step from that, I would say would be the CZ Shadow 2 is a real popular one. And then from there, you're going to start moving up to – I guess more of the race gun style. So then you're looking at the 2011s, which is basically a double stack 1911 in 9mm. So then you have your different brands there. You're going to have your formerly known as STI. Now it's called Staccato. You're going to have your Atlas firearms, your Honchos. And then the big one is the Infinity, which, they are
Infinity?
Like a Formula One of Infinity. FBI Infinity. If you ever look at them, their firearms are all custom built from just a block of steel. They start out they're amazing firearms. If you ever get to see one or shoot one,
FBI Infinity, is that what it's called? I'll have to look it up.
SBI, SBI Infinity. Yep.
V as in Victor or B as in Bravo?
V as in Victor.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah, those are probably about the average. But like I said, Glock 34, but you're actually probably seeing a lot more who really start getting serious into it are moving to the CZ Shadow 2s.
That's Czechoslovakian, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay.
And then they're U.S.-based out of Kansas City.
So are there –
which actually CZ just bought Colt, so –
CZ bought Colt. That's interesting. Yeah, from what I've heard, they're quite reliable, quite good firearms. I have not owned one yet, but I think
they
my next 9mm.
They are really good firearms. So,
because
you're kind of getting, you know, the all metal and the weight of like a 1911, 2011, you know, with a little bit different grip style. But yeah, they're great. I have a CZ TSO Tactical Sport Orange in 40 that I shoot for limited major in USPSA.
Okay. So what I'm curious about is Glock. You know, I mean, originally Glock's like, that's a plastic gun. We don't want that. Are you going to defend yourself with a plastic gun? Well, that plastic gun is pretty popular. It proves that, you know, the polymer frame, you know, does just fine. Thank you very much. The steel components are the ones they have to be. But what is it about Glocks? Do they still have that sort of mystique about them? Or is it just that they're, you know, from my point of view, the maintenance of them is like dirt simple. You really, you'd be hard-pressed to screw up the maintenance on a Glock. They just work. They're simple. They're straightforward. But for ownership, you know, but competition, you think this is such a good wheeler gun. It's also good for competition.
So I guess there's two ways to look at it. I think some people that use it for competition also like it because it's normally what they carry in their normal day-to-day carry gun. Maybe they're carrying a Glock 19 or a Glock 17 or even a Glock 26. So you basically have the same function as your competition gun. So they're getting that muscle memory.
Okay.
Then Glocks, you know, of course, and of course you're going to have all the Glock haters out here debating this, but they are very, very reliable. And then yeah. The maintenance is real low. You'll hear people that never clean their Glock, which I don't recommend. Clean your Glock after each match, but there's a lot of people, you know, that don't clean them. Whereas the 2011s, you have to keep those things oiled like a machine. So, but yeah, I think as far as why people tend to go towards the Glock, one, a lot of people already have one, so they don't want to, you know, put in a lot of money starting in a competition. Hey, let me shoot what I have, and they realize it works for them. And then I'm kind of guilty of this. You know, they'll go to a different gun and they like it, or they go back to Glock. I actually, you know, started out with Glock. I have 2011s and everything, which I shoot in other divisions. But once I started shooting carry optics, I went back to Glock. I shoot a Glock 34 in carry optics because to me, it fits better in my hands, you know, the geometry and ergonomics. Some people just don't like it because of the way the grip feels in their hands. Some people like a little bit more weight in their gun. I like it. I'm a certified Glock armorer, so I know how to work on those things and, you know, soup them up, as you say, to make them competition ready. But, yeah, I really enjoy I like the Glocks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other aspect of them, once you start talking to the really hardcore competitors, the reason why they don't like Glocks is the joke. I don't know what it is in USPSA, but they're like, you know, Glocks for the poors, because USPSA is kind of like, hey, who has the best gun? It's like the kid at school, you know, who has the most toys.
Right.
So, yeah, they're like, oh, we're shooting with the poors because we're shooting people at Glocks. Because, you know, the 2011 guns, you're starting out.
What's the 2011?
At least.
Is that a Glock made gun, or who makes 2011s?
So they're made by Staccato. They're made by SBI. They're made by Atlas. A bunch of other gunsmiths make them. So they're a double stack 1911 platform that shoots 9mm.
So 2011 is the classification.
Super,
okay. All right. Got it.
Yeah.
All right.
And of course, you know, because, you know, you're starting out price $3,000 to $4,000 for one. And then you start getting into, and those are the lower end, then you start getting into the open guns, you're looking $6,000 on up. You know,
oh, geez. $6,000 for a gun?
So when you're looking
Glocks
at a
what?
Glock, you know.
$450? $500?
Yeah, $450, yeah. $600 probably for a Glock 34. So, yeah, so. That's where it's like, oh, you know, people who can't afford this, they say shoot Glocks. But last year during Nationals, the majority of the people that won up in the top 10 all were shooting plastic guns, either Glocks or SIGs. So that was kind of the whole debate. Everybody's like, hey, I guess you don't need an all-steel gun. So,
yeah.
You know.
Well, I love SIGs except for the double action, and we're getting a little technical here, but the first round – you know, your trigger pressure is so much higher than the subsequent shots. I wish they would make, you know, SIGs that were consistent. Glock has a little stronger pull than a single action pull with a cocked hammer. But they're consistent. So your first shot is the same as your second and third. But my Beretta and other, you know, I've owned SIGs, you know, and the SIGs are so high, the barrel's high enough that it seems to pop more in my hand than a Glock, which seems to push back. And I'm much more in favor of the pushing back gun than the one that sort of rises the muzzle as it goes. Then you have to bring it back down again. Yeah. Okay, we've only got about 8 minutes left, and I want to make sure that we covered, if you had a specific topic, because I'll ask questions all day. But what did you want to talk about?
Well,
anything else you want to cover?
So
yeah.
This weekend we are going to Dothan, Alabama. We are shooting the 2021 Endless Summer Blast. It's hosted by the owner of the range, and they have it every year. Dan Mitchell owns and runs the range. It's a beautiful range. We all kind of call it the Wimbledon of USPSA. Their bays are groomed golf grass. They have the best drainage, and they're actually going to host the Alabama State USPSA match there. It's such an amazing match. Even he built a shoot house that is USPSA approved. There's going to be 10 stages, and they're giving away 10 firearms at the end of the match, along with other prizes. Chappie Tactical is a sponsor as well. I donated ammunition that's going to be given away.
Wow.
Then next weekend, then we are traveling to Venerable, Alabama for USPSA.
Uh-huh.
And then the week after that, we are going to Hattiesburg, Mississippi for the 2021 Pittman Arms Mississippi Steel Challenge Championship. So
you work with guns all day and you shoot guns all weekend. You got a tough life there. It sounds like
I've made ammo the last two days. So
wow.
So speaking of which, ammunition.
Yes,
so
mm-hmm.
because of the whole Russia thing, you know, about bringing in their ammunition, I think a lot of people are scared about, you know, hey, how am I going to feed my AK and stuff like that? Well,
mm-hmm.
we're kind of working a deal right now with a Polish ammunition company
mm-hmm.
to bring in ammunition that feeds those AK-47s. So that's something to look for in the near future, and I'll keep you posted.
Yeah.
I may be making a trip over to Poland to come to check out their factory too.
Wow. Hey, can you call us from Poland? We got a Skype line.
Yeah,
be great.
Sure can.
We've had a little trouble in the past. I have to fix it up, but that's one of the projects. Yeah, because ammunition, you know, now for those, so AK-47 based guns, a lot of the foreign importers have steel cases. Do they hurt your gun more? If you're in battle, you don't care. It's like steel. Hey, okay, I'll shoot anything. My life depends on it. But in terms of preserving an AK-47, you know, are you better off with brass cases and paying a little extra for those? Long term, or does it matter?
I think long term. AKs run out on anything, you know, so they love that stuff. The ammunition we'd be getting, of course, be brass casing.
Right.
In the long run, I wouldn't run steel all the time because it's
mm-hmm.
just gonna mess your gun up after a while.
Yeah.
But
yeah, like
AKs,
if you battle,
though,
it's so
they can take it.
You make new ones. You know,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. AKs because it's just, they're so mass produced over there, and they just eat up and run on anything that, yeah, steel is just more cost efficient, I guess, in those countries. So,
yeah.
But here, and especially mm-hmm. in our firearms, definitely shoot brass.
Okay, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
But,
the competition, I'd love to have you bring on more of the guests. In fact, if you have, you know, we don't have to limit you to the Friday time. So in other words, if you have a guest, you know, or a major competition coming up or something like that, you want to bring someone on during the week that we can talk about these things, because it sounds like, well, let me ask you this. Are these competitions televised?
So the World Steel Challenge match in Talladega, it's televised online. There's live feeds, and actually some of the USPSA matches are live feeds. So that's actually mm-hmm. a good topic you brought up, because that's been the talk about how we're going to try to expand this sport.
That's what I was getting to. Yeah, exactly.
And so it's kind of hard because, you know, you're watching something, and unlike other sports, you know, there's a few minutes, even when, like, let's say baseball, you know, they're at least up there for a couple minutes before three strikes or they hit the ball.
Mm-hmm.
USPSA, you know, you're up there and then 10 seconds and it's done. And the camera doesn't want to show, you know, people scoring and pacing. So there's talks of, hey, maybe there's a way that they can do a ticker, you know, with the score of that person that's just shot. And then they're going to have to split up what it's called the super squad. Typically at a big match like that, all the top hitters are on one squad. So you'd have like your Shane Coley from Team Glock with your mm-hmm. JJ Ricaza from Beretta. You'd have to almost split them up. And so, like, let's say for instance, JJ shoots. And after that one's done, the score's put up there. Okay, let's go to squad two. And it shows Shane about ready to start. So there's going to be a lot of different coordination, and then you're talking about camera angles, because that's been the thing too. They've been using drones, which is okay, but some of it kind of distracts from the shooter. So I mean, there's options though. They can do the, like how the NFL, you know, has the cameras on the string that goes across. There's options, but of course it's all, they're looking at, you know, hey, how are we going to keep the cost down of the matches versus doing all this stuff. But there has to be that middle ground somewhere if they really want to expand the sport, because, you know, you're not just going to turn on ESPN and watch a USPSA match. So.
Oh, come on. People watch golf. Jesus. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
That's watching grass
golf.
Grow. Yeah.
And I'm glad you mentioned golf, because it's kind of the same thing. You know how, like Tiger Woods will, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, play hole 9. Okay, now let's go over here, the so-and-so plan holds 7. So that's how they're going. That's how they would have to do it for USPSA, I think, to bring in people to watch the sport and stuff like that.
Unless
so,
they just
and then, of
it.
Course,
you know, they don't have to do a live broadcast, but you say, you know, you can do the live broadcast, but you can do an edited one and just cut out all that time. Just have producers go through or editors go through and take out the time between the events where you have consistent shooters, they shoot, the next one is there and they shoot, and you just sort of eliminate the time in between when they're scoring and walking around doing all the stuff that go on in matches. But you just do the highlights. I think that'd be very exciting because it'd be shooter after shooter after shooter.
Oh,
might be a better way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, there's technology to do it out there now too, because it was almost just done by almost like the last match. It looked like it was just done by Facebook Live. And the bad part is too, it's no offense to these ranges, but of course, you know, a lot of ranges are in the middle of nowhere because just how it is. And there's, you know, a lack of internet connection and stuff like that. So, but there's company, I mean, all you have to do is bring out, you know, look at these mobile news stations with their satellite communication. There's ways to do it. It's just, I think USPSA is going to have to really accept the fact, hey, we want to do this. Here's what we're going to have to do.
Yeah.
I mean, well, and it's not that hard. You have teenagers that can make great movies with their phone and live stuff. Mm-hmm. So just hire a teenager.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, and that's something we might want to do too, is bring USPSA on the show and let's talk to them, because we're pretty creative here on ideas, and maybe we can give them some of these things to make it more interesting. But it strikes me as a televisable sport. You know, you just have to figure out exactly, you know, how to do it. But if you cut out some of the different stuff, but you know, I would compare it to the Olympics. Okay, so the way they do the Olympics, you don't sit there at gymnasts all day long. They cut from event to event to event. You know, and they show you the highlights. You know, you don't see somebody warming up and waiting to hop on the balance beam. You show them walking out to the balance beam. You know, it's the same kind of thing. And so the Olympics, and then you got people that practice, you know, their entire lives for 2 minutes on a balance beam, you know, and they do it over and over and over again. It's you know, the discipline people practice years at the shooting sports for that, you know, 30 seconds of time that they're actually in an event. And so I think there's a way to do that. If you use the Olympics as a format, you have several cameras, you cut from event to event, and you just, you know, and then you might have to do some editing, kind of cut and paste to make sure it all works like they do in the evenings. They show you the day stuff, but by the evening, they've got an edited version for people to watch. Anyway, we're out of time. So I'm going to let you do a shameless plug for yourself, and then let's keep talking.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, I'm Don Chapman from Chappie Tactical and Firearms here in Navarre, Florida. You can reach me on Instagram @ChappieTactical and on Facebook on Facebook.com/ChappieTactical.
Sounds good. Let's do it again next week. Yeah, Gene. Yeah, we didn't get Gene a chance. Gene, if you want to ask a question, I know you're always there, but feel free to leap into a conversation. And Chappie, like I say, if you need more time during the week for a guest, I will schedule it. Not a problem.
Yeah, and actually, I'll call you from Mississippi next Friday. So.
Well, that sounds good. Let's do it. Yeah, our own location gun reporter, Chappie Chapman. All right, good stuff. All right, sir, thank you very much. And we're out of time. We'll do it again.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank
you.
Good luck in your competitions. Yeah, yeah. Greg Penglis for Action Radio. I want to thank everybody that participated this week. This is an amazing amount of information that we were able to get to people. And so I'll be back Monday. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. See you again Monday morning, 6 o'clock Central, 7 o'clock Eastern Time.